In the current Republican playbook, there are only so many maneuvers you can turn to, especially with facts being off limits. In responding to swine flu, however, the Republican Party's chosen talking heads have opted for an oldie but a goodie, making scapegoats out of Mexicans. Republican Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann said she found it, quote, interesting that the last swine flu outbreak was in 1976 under another Democratic president, Jimmy Carter, one who took office in 1977. But Republican commentators, from the radio clowns to the respected journalists at Fixed News, have resurrected the shrewd political tactic that served them so well last year, of using our loose border controls with Mexico to terrify Americans. Exactly how does that apply, though, to the people who the Centers for Disease Control confirmed actually carried the swine flu from Mexico to the U.S.? A group of Catholic school students from New York City who spent spring break in Cancun. Uncontrolled Catholic immigration? Open borders for private school kids are reckless? Anyway, unswayed by the facts, the Republican echo chamber tried to stir the American melting pot with its classic recipe of hate and fear.
You thought that we had an immigration problem. Well, now they might actually want to prevent the sick people from crossing over the border.
Chaos in Mexico, from earthquakes to swine flu. Will it mean more illegals heading for the U.S.?
Does anybody wish maybe we could control the border just a little bit at this point?
And everybody's emailing going, the illegals are bringing it across the border.
Tonight, swine flu spreads from Mexico to the United States. Is this the latest border crisis?
The U.S. is not currently testing travelers from Mexico, but customs officials are wearing protective clothing.
Illegal aliens are carriers of the new strain of human swine avian flu from Mexico. Is this a terrorist attack?
Some, though, say the solution is to close the border.
Now, talk that we should even close the border?
If this is so important, why haven't we closed the border?
There's the bioterrorism angle. What better way to sneak a virus in this country than to give it to Mexicans?
This week in radical history for the week starting May 11th. I'm traveling this week, so this week's show is an abridged version of what you've come to know and love. May 19th of next week, I'll be back in Glee Glee Studios ready to kick it. Until then, enjoy some radical history. But first, this PSA from 1976.
Yo, check this out, man. I don't need another flu shot. I had a flu shot last year.
A swine flu epidemic may be coming.
Swine flu shot? Well, I don't know. I've been thinking about it.
It could make you very sick.
Swine flu? Man, I'm too fast for that to catch me.
You'll want to be protected.
I'm the healthiest 55-year-old you've ever seen. Hey, I play golf every weekend.
Get a shot of protection. The swine flu shot.
The 1976 flu shot killed 10 times as many people getting the vaccine as those who got the flu. Stay informed by checking out some radical thoughts on radical emergency preparedness by visiting aftershockaction.org, an alternative to government propaganda. That's aftershockaction.org. Now, back to the show.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
For the date, May 11th, 1846, U.S. proclaims Manifest Destiny as U.S. takes half of Mexico. Also on May 11th, 1886, Milwaukee newspaper runs articles and ads stating that no polls need apply, as that was that year's anti-immigration propaganda at the time. Also on May 11, 1962, FBI names Martin Luther King Jr. as a communist threat and puts him on a list to be arrested in case of emergencies. You always got to have a backup plan, I guess. Also on May 11, 1967, though many remember Kent State massacre, few remember that Jackson State cops rioted against anti-war protesters, killing one student and wounding many as they fired into the crowd. Also on May 11, 2002, over 50,000 Jews protest the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. On May 12, 1927, Nicaragua. Sandino and his guerrillas decide to continue the fight until they defeat the invading U.S. Marines. A Sandino manifesto asserts, it is better to be killed as a rebel than to live as a slave. May 13, 1771, Robert Owen, one of the founders of socialism, is born. A forerunner to Marx, Owen once famously said about religion, it makes mankind a weak, imbecile animal, a furious bigot and fanatic, or a miserable hypocrite. Also on May 13, 1794, Tom the Tinker helps to organize the Whiskey Rebellion, fighting against the federal taxation of small but not the large distilleries. George Washington organized a 12,000-plus man army to march into Pennsylvania. I guess it was okay for Washington to force taxes on others, just not the other guy. On May 13, 1842, Thomas Dorr's People's Government attempts to seize power in Rhode Island, eventually put down by the state militia. Dorr would eventually be sentenced to life in solitary confinement. On May 13, 1846, U.S. Congress declares war on Mexico. The saying of the day was, "Poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to America." As we take what was to become California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas under pressure from the South to turn them into slave-owning states. God bless us all. On May 13, 1954, Marshall Islanders plead to end the H-bomb testing in their area and all the nuclear fallout from it. More anti-American commies, I'm sure. May 13, 1960, the House Un-American Activities Committee meets as students hold sit-in across the country against red-baiting. On this date, May 14, 1856, private American investor William Walker is officially recognized by U.S. President Franklin Pierce as the pro-slavery dictator of Nicaragua after Walker raises and marches a private army into the country. Later, the people depose him. On May 14, 1905, the Asiatic Exclusion League is formed, making the official start to the anti-Japanese movement, the Japanese being the Mexicans' anti-immigration movement of their day. Also on May 14, 1940, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman dies in Canada while raising money for the anti-Franco whose fascist forces took over Spain. Among many writings of Emma, she famously once said about the American political system, "If voting ever really changed anything, they would have made it illegal." Another famous quote of hers is, "If I can't dance, I don't want to be a part of your revolution." Her grave can be found in Chicago and is a kind of pilgrimage site for many anarchists around the world to visit. Again, Red Emma dies May 14, 1940 in Canada. On May 14, 1960, police beat and drag over 200 protesters at a House Un-American Activities hearing in San Francisco. Police beatings being obviously very American. Also on May 4, 1968, students, followed by many laborers and artists, start strike to take over French government. By the end of the month, over 10 million Frenchmen are involved. Similar demonstrations would spread to Berlin, Rome, Madrid, and other large cities around the world. Capitalists shake in their fur-lined boots. Also on May 4th, 1970, before Kent State, there was Jackson State, where the government shot into the crowd, killing students at anti-war demonstration. However, at Jackson State, the two students were black, therefore not deserving of a pop song like Four Dead in Ohio. On May 5th, 1834, against a Supreme Court ruling, Cherokee Indians forced march out of their lands, which become known as the Trail of Tears. Out of the 12,000 forced marched, almost half died along the way. This mass killing by the U.S. government would spur on the Seminole tribe's resistance in Florida. Also on May 15, 1855, America's first great poet, Walt Whitman, registers the first great book of poetry, Leaves of Grass. Also May 15, 1971, Paris Commune takes over national government seat for 2 months. The National Guard is formed by former army soldiers and laborers to fight against the German-backed forces. Also on May 15, 1935, National Labor Relations Act passed, allowing workers the right to organize in collective bargaining. Also on May 15, 1947, House passes $400 million funding to fight communism, and the first members of the general public start naming names at the House Un-American Activities hearings held in Washington, D.C. Also on May 15, 1964, U.S. starts mass bombing of Laos, effectively destroying this small country. Also on May 15, 1968, students fight German police as new emergency laws are passed to stop public from demonstrating. Also on that date, 1969, then-Governor Ronald Reagan orders raids on the hippies camping in the People's Park. Also on that date, 1970, several million students hold strikes against the war around the nation. Also on May 15, 1971, several thousand Hopi Indians forced to relocate as strip mining companies take over their lands. Also on May 15, 1989, government records released show that Noral Noriega was the, quote, CIA man, unquote, in Panama. Years later, was arrested by U.S. forces and convicted. Can you say Saddam Hussein? On May 16, 1913, first woman's anti-slavery convention is held. Also on May 16, 1871, yes, that's right, 1871, U.S. invades Korea to force open trade routes. He is kicked out a month later. Well, we'll be back again and again. Also on May 16, 1904, U.S. deports anarchist John Turner. The Supreme Court rules that the U.S. has the right to deport anyone, even philosophical anarchists, if they so choose. Yep, the land of the free, all right. Also, May 16, 1918, President Wilson signs into law the Sedition Act, making it illegal to obstruct, enlist, or speak against war materials, the American government, etc., etc. More land of the free stuff. Also on May 16, 1933, the first blacklist of unacceptable books is created in Nazi Germany. Also on May 16, 1943, we saw the Warsaw Poland Ghetto Uprising. 53,000 would die eventually. Now it's being fought in the ghettos of Palestine. Now the victims become the victimizers. And it goes on and on and on. That's all the time we got for this week's This Week in Radical History. For more interesting and fun radical facts, check out the People's Calendar by Googling the Daily Bleed. More information also came from the Slingshot Organizer, Google Slingshot Collective for more information. From the Glee Studios, and until next week, as always, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. Omar Barghouti, co-founder and leading voice of the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, spoke to a full house at Harvard University following his long period of detention by the Israeli military. He was finally able to do his United States speaking tour, which was postponed due to his arrest. We feature his main address and as much of the question and answer period as time will allow. The Q&A may be difficult to follow because they took three questions at a time and then let Barghouti answer them. But we hope you will be able to follow the flow, especially as he responds to some challenging questions from the Zionist students. Here is Omar Barghouti speaking at Harvard University.
In 1923, Zionist leader Ze'ev Jabotinsky wrote, quote, "Every native population in the world resists colonists as long as it has the slightest hope of being able to rid itself of the danger of being colonized. Zionist colonization must either stop or else proceed regardless of the native population, which means that it can proceed and develop only under the protection of a power that is independent of the native population behind an iron wall which the native population cannot reach." End of quote. A key part of this iron wall that Jabotinsky spoke of is colonizing the minds of the native population, not just the lands, by searing into our consciousness, through hegemonic and sustained power, the imperative of submission to Israel's injustices as fate and the futility of hope in resisting its regime of oppression. Consequently, the long path to justice must commence with exercising our deeply seated fears and inhibitions, and embarking on a radical process of decolonizing our minds. For we cannot possibly pursue freedom while our minds remain colonized, and therefore cannot even envision what freedom looks like. The decolonization of the mind, in turn, demands rekindling our well-founded hope. Hope, after all, can be contagious. This is precisely why Israel is desperately trying to suppress the boycott, divestment, and sanctions of BDS movement, a main source of hope, a key part of Palestinian popular resistance, and the most effective form of international solidarity with the nonviolent Palestinian struggle for freedom, justice, and equality. BDS, after all, has not only insisted on the rights of all Palestinians, it has also rekindled Palestinian aspirations for emancipation, justice, and peace through its effectiveness in showing a nonviolent yet realistic path to achieving them. Moreover, BDS is reestablishing the inherent relationship that the so-called Oslo peace process has all but buried between the struggle for Palestinian rights on the one hand, and on the other hand, the diverse international struggles for racial, economic, gender, social, and climate justice. Begun in 2005 by the broadest coalition in Palestinian civil society, BDS calls for ending Israel's 1967 occupation, ending its institutionalized racial discrimination system, which meets the United Nations definition of apartheid, and upholding the right of Palestinian refugees to return to the homes and lands from which they were uprooted and dispossessed in 1948 and ever since. These three basic rights correspond to the three main components of the Palestinian people, those in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, who constitute 38% of the Palestinian people, according to 2014 statistics, Palestinian citizens of present-day Israel, who constitute 12%, and Palestinians in exile, who are 50% of the Palestinian population. More than two-thirds of Palestinians are either refugees or internally displaced persons. Though launched in 2005, the movement is deeply rooted in decades of Palestinian popular, nonviolent resistance to settler colonialism and ethnic cleansing. It is inspired and strongly influenced by the South African anti-apartheid movement and the U.S. civil rights movement. Anchored in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the BDS movement has consistently and categorically opposed all forms of racism and racial discrimination, including Islamophobia and anti-Jewish racism. One's identity, we believe, should never diminish or restrict one's entitlement to rights. BDS, as a result, targets complicity, not identity. BDS is an inclusive movement that enjoys growing support among diverse communities, including a growing number of Jewish Israeli supporters, who play a significant role in exposing Israel's regime of oppression and advocating for isolating it. Despite the obvious differences between Israel's regime of oppression and that of apartheid South Africa, the similarities are striking, as many Israeli and South African analysts today recognize. Israel's regime of oppression against the Palestinian people may be a unique cocktail as it is, but it is in part a more sophisticated, evolved, and brutal form of apartheid than its South African predecessor. South Africa's Speaker of Parliament, Baleka Mbete, has recently stated, quote, "Apartheid in South Africa was a picnic compared to what we have seen in the occupied Palestinian territories," end of quote. A few weeks ago, ESQA, as was mentioned by Omar, a UN agency, concluded in a report co-authored by Professor Richard Folk, a prominent international law expert and former UN rapporteur for human rights in the occupied territories, that Israel is guilty of the crime of apartheid against the entire Palestinian people, and the same ESQA report called for BDS measures to hold Israel to account. Israeli apartheid, as some Israeli figures today admit, does not stop at the 1967 border. Earlier this year, for instance, Israeli forces destroyed most of Umm al-Hiran, a Bedouin Palestinian village in the Naqab or Negev desert, whose residents are Palestinian citizens of Israel. And they demolished it to establish a Jewish-only colony on its ruins. Israeli forces gave Palestinian families in Umm al-Hiran barely any notice to gather their furniture, photos, books, or children's toys before bulldozing their homes and livelihoods. Far from being an exception, unfortunately, Umm al-Hiran is the norm. Drunk with power and impunity, particularly since Trump's rise to power, Israel has embarked on what Palestinians fear might be an escalation of the ongoing Nakba. It has dropped its thin mask of democracy and enlightenment, moving at a dizzying speed to build as many settlements as possible in the occupied Palestinian territory. As Israel becomes more openly associated with the rising far right around the world, including xenophobic and openly anti-Semitic groups, particularly in the United States and Europe, and as it is more widely considered to be among the belligerently intolerant, faith-driven ethno-states, as Professor Tony Judd, the late Tony Judd, once put it, more people, grassroots movements, and progressive institutions will feel the moral imperative to join the BDS movement as the most effective form of solidarity with Palestinian rights, and as one of the facets of the growing global resistance to the far right. Richard Spencer, one of those leaders of the far right in this country, or alt-right as they call them here, has even defended the white supremacist movement's racist nationalism as, quote, a sort of white Zionism. This unmistakable allusion to Israel's exclusionary foundations as a state that privileges Jewish settlers over the indigenous Palestinian population and that treats African asylum seekers as, quote, a cancer, further exposes the often obscured contradiction between Zionism and liberal ideals. As this contradiction becomes more visible, support for holding Israel to account is growing among Jewish Americans, especially millennials, as well as the broader U.S. public. A 2014 poll shows that 46% of non-Orthodox Jewish American men under 40 support a full boycott of Israel to end its occupation. Almost half. More recently, in 2016, a Brookings Institution poll shows almost half of all Americans support imposing sanctions or tougher measures against Israel to stop its illegal settlements. You don't see your politicians reflecting those polls, but one day they will. These polls and other indicators point to the impressive growth in the last few years of the Palestinian-led BDS, Movement for Palestinian Rights. We draw a lot of inspiration from the growing bonds of mutual solidarity with movements defending the rights of refugees, immigrants, women, workers, Black Americans, Muslims, Native Americans, and the LGBTQI community, and from the fact that the time-honored tactic of boycott has become the nonviolent weapon of choice for Americans opposing Trump and businesses connected to him or his daughter. Or son-in-law, or... Since hope based on illusions does not bring the oppressed any closer to justice, one must always ask whether the hope that we are nourishing is based on not just moral consistency, but also effective strategies of resistance that can take us there. In this respect, the impact of BDS must be assessed in light of its two closely related strategies: raising awareness worldwide about the UN-stipulated rights of the entire Palestinian people, and raising the material and psychological cost of Israel's regime of oppression by mobilizing individuals, institutions, civil society, and eventually states to end their practical complicity in maintaining this regime of injustice. Recent international public opinion polls, together with Israel's hysterical reaction, indicate that BDS is succeeding on both fronts. Days ago, the municipality of Barcelona in Spain announced measures to end complicity in Israel's occupation and settlements regime and defended the right to pursue Palestinian rights through BDS tactics. This follows dozens of municipalities across the Spanish state that had recently declared themselves Israeli apartheid-free zones. In September 2015, Veolia, the French corporate giant, became the first international company to end all involvement in Israeli illegal operations, following an extensive seven-year BDS campaign that cost the company tenders around the world worth over $20 billion. This has triggered a domino effect, with companies like Orange and CRH also pulling out of the Israeli economy in 2016. Bowing to BDS pressure after suffering what the Financial Times called reputational damage, G4S, the world's largest private security company, decided also in 2016 to end most of its involvement in Israel's illegal business, especially the incarceration business and the settlement protection and the checkpoint protection. G4S had lost contracts in Jordan, Norway, Lebanon, the European Parliament, South Africa, Colombia the country, not Columbia University, obviously. Soon Columbia University, we hope. In the first week of 2016, the $20 billion pension and health benefits fund of the United Methodist Church declared the five largest Israeli banks off limits for investment and divested from the two that it held in its portfolios. This followed the lead of the second largest Dutch pension fund, PGGM, which in 2014 divested from all Israeli banks. The Presbyterian Church USA has voted to divest from Caterpillar, Hewlett-Packard, and Motorola Solutions, as did other mainline churches in the US, because of those companies' involvement in Israel's occupation. The credit ratings agency, Moody's, has assessed that if BDS grows further, it will have a significant impact on Israel's economy. This gradually growing economic impact has come after years of BDS successes in the cultural and academic domains. Over 1,000 black activists, artists, scholars, students, and organizations in the US and elsewhere have endorsed BDS, for instance, and so did the Movement for Black Lives. Since 2015, thousands of cultural figures in Canada, Ireland, South Africa, and the UK have adopted a cultural boycott of Israel, which is institutional, targets institutions, not individuals. While many artists have cancelled gigs in Tel Aviv or refused to perform there in the first place, of the 26 Oscar nominees in 2016 who were offered expensive, extremely expensive, all paid propaganda trips by the Israeli government, none has taken. 6 out of 11 NFL players in this country, including the great Michael Bennett, have turned down a similar Israeli junket. Academic associations and tens of student governments at Stanford, UCLA, Berkeley, Northwestern, and many other US, Canadian, and UK universities have voted for various BDS measures, including divestment from companies involved in Israel's violations of human rights. But BDS cannot claim full responsibility for Israel's growing academic, cultural, and increasingly economic isolation. Israel itself takes a lot of that credit. Israel's 2015 election brought to power its most racist government ever, which has busied itself passing racist laws at an unprecedented rate through the Israeli parliament. Israeli government ministers have adopted unabashed and unmasked far-right racism, while just a few months ago, Israel's chief rabbi for the Sephardic community called for the ethnic cleansing of Gentiles, quote, from the land of Israel. Leading Israeli political and military figures have voiced huge concerns about Israel's descent into an abyss. Ehud Barak, a former prime minister, who is incidentally accused of committing many war crimes against Palestinians, yet he's a scholar here at Harvard, I hear, Ehud Barak warned that Israel has been, quote, infected by the seeds of fascism. While the current Israeli deputy chief of staff Major General Yair Golan has compared, quote, revolting trends in Israeli society to Germany in the 1930s. Israel's lurch to the far right and beyond has inadvertently amplified support for Palestinian rights and for BDS tactics to attain them. The annual BBC Globe scan of international public opinion, for example, has in recent years shown Israel competing with North Korea in popularity, including among Europe's largest nations, by the way. Having lost many battles for the hearts and minds at the grassroots level, Israel adopted in 2014 a new top-down strategy to combat the BDS movement after its previous strategy of spending millions on propaganda alone on the so-called Brand Israel campaign has largely failed. Evoking memories of McCarthyism, the new strategy employs legal warfare, espionage, and intensified propaganda to undermine or even outlaw BDS advocacy. One desperate Israeli government minister has publicly threatened leading BDS activists with, quote, targeted civil assassination, while another established a, quote, tarnishing unit, that's the official name, tarnishing unit, to smear BDS activists and networks around the world. An Israeli anti-BDS law, recently passed, denies entry to anyone who supports or is associated with an organization that endorses BDS or merely advocates for selective boycotts targeting Israeli settlements. The Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs is working on a blacklist, quote-unquote, of Israelis who are active in any BDS or even partial boycott activities. In the US, France, and elsewhere, Israel's deeply influential lobbies are working overtime to promote suppression of free speech on Palestinian rights and to criminalize, or at the very least demonize, BDS activism. Congress is currently considering one of these draconian anti-BDS laws that arguably violate the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, as the ACLU has opined. This new anti-BDS strategy appears to be failing, as some major Israeli and Israel lobby groups today admit. In a major setback for Israel's legal war on BDS, for example, the European Union, no less, as well as the governments of Sweden, Ireland, and Netherlands, have come out in support of the right to BDS, as did Amnesty, the International Federation for Human Rights, the American Civil Liberties Union, and many, many others. But another weapon of choice wielded by Israel and its lobby groups against its critics is the anti-Semitism smear. So I'll expand a bit on this point, because I think it's very important. Israel and the Zionist movement have been aggressively trying to normalize and impose a new definition of anti-Semitism that encompasses anti-Zionism, criticism of Israel's policies or laws, and advocacy of effective measures to hold Israel accountable to international law, especially through BDS measures. Ethical principles aside, this attempted distortion of the concept of anti-Jewish racism to protect Israel from censure and accountability dehumanizes Palestinians by portraying our struggle against Israel's regime of oppression as if fueled by a visceral hatred towards Jews, not a genuine human pursuit of freedom, justice, and equality like any sane human being. This fraudulent anti-Semitism dogma presents a substantial danger to people of conscience everywhere, including those of the Jewish faith, standing in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for rights, as it seeks to delegitimize human rights campaigning against Israel's system of injustice or even its specific policies. Conflating opposition to the State of Israel with anti-Semitism is also perilous to Jewish communities the world over, as it dilutes the notion of anti-Jewish racism beyond recognition and arguably nourishes real anti-Jewish bigotry by indirectly implicating all Jewish communities and Jewish persons at large in Israel's egregious crimes against the Palestinians and others. Zionism, after all, has always thrived on real anti-Semitism, including during the rise of the Nazi anti-Jewish legislation in Germany in the 1930s, viewed by the Zionist movement at the time as a victory against the worst enemy of Zionism, assimilation. To end this part, there is nothing Jewish about Israel's system of oppression. Since there's nothing Jewish about Israel's occupation or apartheid, there's nothing inherently anti-Jewish in opposing Israel's occupation and apartheid. To conclude, the great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish once wrote that he wished he could be liberated of Palestine so he could write poems of love, life, and mundane topics. But so long as Palestinian liberation itself remained elusive, Darwish wrote, he had no choice but to write about Palestine. Inspired by Darwish, I have a deep desire myself to end my BDS activism, indeed, to see the BDS movement itself come to an end. For this to happen, though, we need to attain our freedom, justice, and equality first. When, not if, this happens, I'll be exhilarated to redirect my deep passion for human rights to other struggles that I'm particularly passionate about, especially the struggle by blacks for racial and economic justice and the struggle of indigenous communities around the world for reparations. When, not if, we attain our comprehensive rights, I'll be delighted to fulfill my other passions in life, especially philosophy and choreography. But until then, I have no choice but to continue my modest contribution to this most noble struggle for a life that is worth living, as Darwish puts it, and that can only be a life under freedom, justice, and equality. Thank you.
And I get to ask the first question, and would like to ask a question that I think I came with, and maybe it's already been answered, but I think I might be one of those people who is very familiar with BDS, but has a little bit of apprehension about the academic and cultural boycott. It feels as if one is somehow destroying some of the fabric of academia to be boycotting other academics and the cultural issues that bring Israel and its critics often together. So I'd like to ask a little more about that, what that means exactly, and perhaps to be slightly more specific, you mentioned these trips to Israel that have been offered to Oscar nominees and others, but that also is true in the university setting, and certainly here at Harvard College, where there are many students who are sort of of Jewish origin. You have some Jewish part of their heritage, but have never been to Israel. And they are sponsored for trips to Israel. More recently, however, that's been expanded. And there are Muslim students and students from the interfaith world here at Harvard from other backgrounds who would like to go to Israel and who are sponsored, whether by Hillel or some outside organization, again, on an all-expenses trip to Israel. And so how do you think about those sorts of things? So that, I mean, these are presumably educational. I always ask if they go anywhere on the West Bank. They may sometimes do go to Palestine, sometimes not very long. So I think for those of us in the university, the issue of what an academic and cultural boycott really means would be very important for us.
Thank you. Actually, thanks for the question. It's very pertinent because there's a lot of misunderstanding about the Palestinian-led academic and cultural boycott. Those who are old enough in this room, there aren't many, but some, who might have been involved in the South African anti-apartheid movement, as I was when I went to school at Columbia, would remember that the boycott, academic and cultural boycott against South African apartheid, was a blanket boycott that targeted every single academic artists, as well as institutions in South Africa. Everyone was off limits for us then. The Palestinian Academic and Cultural Boycott, though, is institutional only. We do not target Israeli individuals because we do not target identity. We target complicity. All Israeli institutions, academic and cultural, are involved in Israel's violations of human rights to varying degrees. All of them. That's why we target them. We do not target individuals. So if, let's say, Harvard has an exchange program with Tel Aviv University, we target that. We're trying to cut links of complicity between academics and institutions outside with Israeli institutions, but not with Israeli academics. Continuing relations with Israeli academics, they publish, they tour the world, they participate in conferences, they teach, they do everything that academics do. There's nothing in BDS that infringes on their academic freedom in any way. And those debates happen at the American Anthropological Association and the Modern Language Association, American Studies, National Women's Association, and many, many, many associations where BDS was passed or debated. And the other side came out really not having a very coherent argument about trying to say that BDS infringes in any way on academic freedom, because it doesn't. On the second point about student trips that are funded by Israel, propaganda trips, basically. Israel took a page out of South Africa's apartheid regime's propaganda. South Africa used to do the exact same thing. Sponsor trips by artists and students and trade union leaders and so on. Come see South Africa, the only developed economy in God-forsaken Africa, and so on and so forth. We have better gay rights and better women's rights and better for whites, obviously, but regardless, I mean, that's a minor detail. Israel, in the same thing, sponsors, spends tens and tens of millions of dollars on free trips to just about anyone who's interested. Third-rate Hollywood figures, retired artists who want to come back to the stage, just about anyone is welcome, and they're paid very handsomely, to try to project an image of Israel as if it's a liberal, dynamic society to cover up its minor problem of occupation, apartheid, and settler colonialism. So it's really a form of whitewashing, pinkwashing, greenwashing, all kinds of washing. One thing that all this washing has in common, there's a lot of dirt to wash.
Hi, my name is Hazani Fadamada. I'm a proud daughter of a Palestinian refugee who lived in 1948. My question to you is, we are at Harvard University, one of the most prominent, supposedly, policy schools in the country, and arguably the world, yet we have a narrative on our campus that this is an anti-Israeli campus, an anti-Jewish campus, and anybody who engages in advocacy around this part gets kind of told accordingly. I wonder what we can do as students to better mobilize our voices to the mainstream powers that be and lobbies that be, and how we get to a place where being Palestinian and actually having an identity on campus isn't perceived to be a crime and treated accordingly.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Willie. How are you doing? I was wondering, well, when you think about the framework about this issue, how important you put the role of political Zionism in terms of settler colonialism in Palestine. And considering those two points, Zionism and settler colonialism, what impact and implications do you think that has on how a solution could be reached, and what obviously points that should be derived from that?
And the question on Palestinian identity at Harvard, I went to school at Columbia, so we have it very easy here. I mean, seriously. It was a jungle out there. So talk about Palestinian identity. I was joking with a number of activists before this that we couldn't in the 80s at Columbia call for ending the occupation. It was considered an extremely, extremely off-the-wall radical statement. Peace in the Middle East was as radical as was tolerated. We did, of course, call for ending the occupation, but we were treated as extremists. But it's very important what you say about Palestinian identity and how immediately, once your voice, your Palestinian voice comes out, you're immediately labeled, you're immediately sneered. There was a point when those Ivy League schools smeared Jewish voices as well, when they banned Jewish students as well. Mm-hmm. So they have a history of racism against Jews and against blacks and against women, you name it. The discrimination is in the history of these Ivy League schools. It's about time we assert our Palestinian voices and we make sure that they listen to us. And if they don't, we mobilize and grow our power until they have to listen to us.
Professor Barghouti, before I begin, I just want to say that it's historically inaccurate.
Professor
Barghouti, I just want to state that it's historically inaccurate to make the claim that the Jews ever had equal rights in the East. I think that if you read Martin Gilbert, a foremost Jewish scholar on Jewish history, he made it very clear that Jews were actually routinely reminded of their second-class status across the Arab world, whether it was in Egypt or across the Muslim world, including Iran. Now, my question goes as follows. In March, you were arrested in Israel on a massive tax fraud case involving around $700,000 of hidden income. Despite this, Israel allowed you to come to the United States on this tour.
So gracious.
Unimaginable that in the U.S. and the U.K., for instance, someone who's accused of such crimes would be permitted just to travel freely. Would an apartheid state allow one of its harshest critics, recently involved in massive tax fraud, to go out of the country and engage in propaganda against them?
Hi, I'm Leila. For 38 years, for 38 years, I've done public speaking, organizing for Palestine. The last one was in 2002, the Somerville Divestment Project, in which we put ballots on the election, and they were very successful. Maybe we didn't get 50%, but I consider it 45% success, because we reached large numbers of people, we heard the voters' opinions, we talked to people on the streets. Recently, I went to a conference in Detroit where my daughter spoke at an academic conference. And in the middle of the night, in our hotel, Homeland Security showed up and scared us half to death, along with all the other people who went to the conference. I think the problem in this country, I'm not going to talk long, is that there is a system of oppression within the country. And how do we face, in the United States, this system of oppression that stands up with Israel, right or wrong? When I talk about the people, the grassroots we could reach and the universities we could reach, I'm talking about a system of oppression which is oppressing blacks, oppressing natives. And I just heard about something where they had a law like Contra Pro against Arab Americans in the 70s. I never heard about it before. So how do we approach these things and fix? Because Palestine, unfortunately, is oppressed through the United States.
Thank you so much for your presentation. My name is Ari, and I'm both Mexican and Jewish. And I have a question about, I wonder what is your position or the BDS movement position regarding G4S? If they move out of Israel, I think that's a great thing. But unfortunately, they continue to profit with building walls, detention centers, arresting and dispossessing migrants who are trying to cross the border to a land that perhaps they have ancestral rights that many of us don't. So what is the position of the BDS movement regarding G4S, even though they pull out of Palestine, of Israel, but still profiting for the same things? Thank you.
Although the first question came right out of the Israeli Foreign Ministry talking point, I will assume that it was an honest student question, and I will answer it accordingly. I am under a gag order, as you very well know, so I cannot speak at all in any detail about the latest phase of repression against me. I'm not allowed legally to speak. So you're asking me a question knowing well that I cannot answer it. As I wrote, after 12 days of interrogation, that I am not allowed by law to speak about this issue, but I would like to put this in context. I mentioned in my talk, I don't know if you were here, that Israel last year established a tarnishing unit. The Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel, which leads, coordinates the Israeli government's fight against BDS and spends tens of millions of dollars in fighting BDS, last year established a tarnishing unit. That's what they called it. It's not my name. And the tarnishing unit, you can guess what its purpose is, but openly is aimed at tarnishing the reputation of activists in the BDS movement. The point is to dig up any dirt they can find, and if they cannot find it, they fabricate it. So I'll stop at that. Could an apartheid state allow someone like you to leave, or Gracious? What does this have to do with the definition of apartheid? Many blind supporters of Israel, unfortunately, sometimes redefine apartheid according to their liking, their opinion. Your opinion, my opinion, do not matter. Apartheid is a crime against humanity defined in the UN Convention for the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid since 1973. It doesn't matter if Israel has a judge who's Palestinian or a dancer who's Palestinian or allows Omar Gharouti to leave or not to leave. This is completely irrelevant. We are in an academic institution. Let's at least try to stick to some notions that are accepted in international law. Apartheid is a well-defined crime. It's the systematic, legalized racial oppression by one racial group against another, which Israel clearly is. Israel has more than 60 laws that discriminate against its, quote, non-Jewish population simply because they're non-Jewish. 60 laws, not just policies. That is apartheid. Leila's question on what do we do about the U.S. system of oppression, that requires like 3 hours. But I'm sure many of you in this room know much more than I how to face this system of oppression. But I think Leila has touched on a very important part of that, which is the intersectionality of struggles. For too long, many communities were trying to fight the system alone. And guess what? We have not done a very good job. The system is very well united. It targets all of us. The oppressions are working very much in unison. It's high time we start to work in unison. And not in a transactional, opportunistic way of you scrub my back and I scrub yours, but in a real, organic, principled alliance of justice struggles that connect the struggle by blacks for justice, by women, LGBTQI, by Latinos, and so on and so forth, the indigenous population of this land, together against the system. Because the system, more than ever, is not just a far-right system, a xenophobic system, a racist system. It's a corporate system. It's a military, security industrial complex system. It's so blunt now with the Trump administration, I think he's making life easier for us because the target is much easier to see. We will suffer a lot under Trump, all of us, the whole world, as well as communities of color in this country, many marginalized communities in this country. But one thing is clearer, the enemy is clearer than ever. It's about time we unite. This question on G4S, thank you so much for this question. In fact, in my meeting with student activists and community activists before this, we discussed this very issue. Veolia, I mentioned Veolia, the French conglomerate that was forced to quit the Israeli market after losing more than $20 billion worth of contracts around the world. When we won that battle, after 7 years of a BDS campaign, in our statement, we said, we shall continue to support any campaign around the world that targets Veolia because of its involvement in violating people's rights in the water privatization, in all kinds of transport privatization, and many other campaigns. And I think anti-Veolia activists in the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, in Boston in particular, are playing a very important role in connecting our struggle against Veolia with others. I think Nancy Murray is here, I saw her somewhere, and others that I recognize are very much involved in this intersectional struggle. Similarly with G4S, yes, we forced G4S after a 4-year BDS campaign to quit most of its illegal business in Israel. It's still involved in a police training project that we're pursuing it until it stops. But even when we get G4S out, we will continue to support campaigns in the United States, in the UK, in South Africa, in India, anywhere, against G4S because of its involvement in violating human rights in those countries and elsewhere. That's a commitment of principle that we will continue to honor.
So these will be the last questions that we take because we're ending at 9. So people are already here.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Horowitz. I'm a sophomore at the college, and my question is as follows.
Can I just speak up, please?
Sure. My question is as follows. If BDS aims to bring full human rights to the Palestinian people, then why does your movement not boycott the government of Hamas in Gaza, which Amnesty International condemned for torturing Palestinian civilians and uses humanitarian aid money to buy weapons instead of food for its starving population?
Hi, Alex from Stockholm College as well. My question is specifically a pragmatic one of advocacy. As an advocate myself and having worked a bit around this whole thing, as an Israeli, one of the things that frustrated me was the lack of conversation and dialogue and empathy on either side. And this is something that I still find, I think, on both sides of the aisle. BDS, to me, seems like it calls for moving away from the negotiation table, for a boycott as opposed to a conversation. And I'm wondering very pragmatically, whether on college campuses or in these dialogues across the country, where you think this polarization leads, and how you see coexistence after the conversation, or the lack of conversations that are happening.
Hi, my name is Hannah. I am the proud daughter of a Jewish refugee from Nazi Germany in 1938. And in November of last year, when Donald Trump got elected, I finally did what I didn't do in 1981, Ronald Reagan became president, and I didn't do when George W. Bush became president. I actually activated my application for German citizenship to be repatriated to Germany because this does not feel like a safe place. And 80 years after my father was evicted, I have the right to go to Germany. My father is long dead. I'm wondering in that context if you could address the Palestinian right of return under international law as a matter of international moral shared community.
Hi, my name is Ade. I'm from Palestine, that's it. And speaking out of experience, I know hundreds of families in Gaza who are like now living under the line of poverty because their parents are like no longer allowed to work in Israel. So my question is if like BDS does great work and like close small businesses, like big businesses in Israel, where like people from the West Bank work, and like you know that the labor market in Palestine is not the best. So what's an alternative solution for those who will be, for those who will lose their work in Israel / people in Palestine?
Jennifer's question, again, I'll try to convince myself it's not texted by the Minister of Strategic Affairs. I'll assume it's an honest-to-goodness question. A movement seeking full Palestinian human rights, why doesn't it call for boycotting Hamas? Because of its proven violations of human rights and civil rights in Gaza. Now, BDS, as I said earlier, before your question, has a very narrow mandate as a human rights movement. We seek specifically isolating Israel's regime of oppression, corporations and institutions that are involved in maintaining this oppression, until we achieve an end to the occupation, end to apartheid, and the right of return for refugees. It's as simple as that. We do not venture beyond this mandate. Simply, we cannot agree on anything beyond this mandate in this massive coalition that makes up the BDS movement in Palestine. Do we all agree on a social agenda? Not necessarily. Do we all agree with this political ideology or that? Certainly not. But all of us are involved in other struggles as well. It's not like we do BDS and nothing else. Some of us are feminists and work in the women's movement. Some of us work in labor movements. Some of us in the BDS movement in Palestine are gay and lesbian activists, and so on and so forth. They don't do all of this in the BDS movement necessarily. All of us have multiple paths. We continue our struggles for civil rights, for human rights, including against Palestinian repression. So under occupation, under the system of occupation, apartheid and settler colonialism, the system of oppression is the main problem. Israel's system of colonization is the biggest problem we face, obviously. But that doesn't mean we don't have problems on our own, including denying women's equal rights, including so many other rights are being denied. And of course,
as consistent human rights activists, we have to address those, but not necessarily within the BDS movement. We have other movements, you know. It's not like we are monolithic in Palestinian society. As a dance choreographer, I always argue against repression of the arts, of freedom of expression and culture, and so on and so forth, but I have no time to go into that. On the question of dialogue, again, and polarization. Let me address polarization first, and then I'll come back to dialogue. I'll talk about all of it. Polarization. Those who come to a campus and do not want polarization should better stay home. And if you go to any academic institution, respectable or not, you expect debate. You expect people to have controversy. I personally, in my philosophical studies, view controversy as an essential tool for progress. Essential. If you don't want controversy, stay home. You listen to the people that you like, and you don't have to be exposed to corrupting ideas from the other side of the aisle. So polarization is part of life. Live with it. And you know what? Injustice has a tendency of polarizing people. It's not resistance. You know, masters and slaves are usually polarized. It's not the slave's resistance that's making this polarize. It's the relationship of oppression that polarizes more than anything else.
All right, that's right.
Now, going back to the dialogue issue, it sounds fine, but let's really try to unpack that. Masters and slaves never dialogue. Even if they appear as if they're having a dialogue, it's always coercive. I'll give you an anecdote. I was in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, and after a talk with someone from Bethlehem and Israeli, Palestinian, and Dutch speakers, some elected official, Dutch elected official, stood up and said, instead of boycotts, we should love each other. I resisted the tendency to want to puke. And I told him, look, if I see a master and a slave hugging, it is not love, it is rape. It is rape. It is coercion. Even if they appear kissing and loving, it's never love. You cannot have a serious coexistence, let alone love, in the presence of colonial oppression. So, going to dialogue, yes for dialogue, 100%, but ethical dialogue, where you and I believe that we have equal rights. As humans, we deserve equal rights. Where you do not view me as a relative human who deserves a relative, a subset of rights because I'm not a full human. That cannot be a dialogue if it's right. Not based on that basic, profound equality that you view me as an equal human. If you do not view me as an equal human who deserves equal rights to everyone else around this world, I have no interest in having any dialogue with you. Hannah's question, or comment rather, what can I say? Thank you so much. I think it's a brilliant comment from the heart, and I really empathize with that. I know a number of Holocaust survivors, sons and daughters of Holocaust survivors, who made a very similar comment. In fact, some of them, Jewish descendants of Holocaust survivors, have a whole group defending the Palestinian right of return. And I think it's such a noble gesture for such Holocaust survivors to say, just as we said never again to us, we should say never again to anyone. So rights are rights, and we as human rights activists, we have to have an evidence. And the last question from Oday about Gaza laborers. Gaza being under siege for 10 years now, under a horrible siege where Israel is counting calories, average calories entering Gaza to keep people on the verge of starvation, yet not starving yet because it wouldn't look nice on CNN. And this is according to official reports published by CNN, BBC, and others. Under this horrific condition of dehumanization, inhumane conditions where Palestinians, almost 2 million Palestinians in Gaza live, of course, we do not call on Gaza workers, the tiny, tiny, tiny minority who might get permits to work in Israeli projects, that they cannot. BDS does not call for that. We understand that under occupation, that the colonized must deal with coercive relationships. We do not expect Palestinians living under apartheid or occupation to observe the same guidelines of BDS as everyone else who has a choice. Because we're not some romantic activists who seek an ideal situation that's divorced from reality. We understand the reality, and being ethical is being in touch with reality. We understand coercive relationships. A Palestinian in Gaza has no choice but to consume many Israeli products because nothing else is there. And if he or she has any chance, one in a thousand chance, to get a permit to work in an Israeli project, of course, we do not object to that. What we object to are the political leaders, Palestinians, that are, of course, occupation first and foremost, but also the Palestinian Authority, for example, that is investing so much in so-called security coordination rather than in infrastructure, in jobs, in farming and agriculture and so on, creating jobs. So there's a lot of blame, internal blame, on the Palestinian side. But certainly BDS does not call for people to cut their livelihoods. We understand that under oppression, we must deal with the system.
You have been listening to Omar Barghouti, co-founder of the Palestinian BDS movement, speaking at Harvard University.
The public cannot comprehend this weapon and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong. But because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves against it.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, Kevin Carhill and me, Tony Gosling. Police sweep barracks across Germany after uncovering a neo-Nazi terrorist cell in the army. Isn't that news? Yes, a nationwide sweep in Germany of army barracks serving soldiers are discovered with Nazi memorabilia. Meanwhile, an arrested German soldier has planned to blame his own terror attack on Syrian refugees. Quite a sophisticated cell within the German army. Also, former Rothschild banker Macron is the next French president, like the US election. Are the French people being given the choice between a fascist or neoliberal nutcase when they don't want either? North Korea in the news again as the US puts its THAAD missile systems in. Have you seen the South Korean protests on our news? Is THAAD a defensive system? If so, what's the problem? We also look at this week's South Korean elections and ask, is there any real danger in threats by Kim Jong-il and Donald Trump to start a nuclear war? Or is it just saber-rattling? Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday this week. Homeless people from Bristol's Tent Village have set up shop. Now we speak to ex-serviceman Stuart, who lives there. He explains why over a year ago he left the violence and abusive behaviour of a homeless hostel, as others have, to live in a tent. Also, off to Joseph Mengele's merry old China, where people of faith and other prisoners of conscience are being executed by having their organs harvested for profit by the government. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or, if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin and Kevin, I'd just like to bring up that item that we heard in the news there about the cyber attack on the National Health Service again. I know we mentioned it in the last hour, but it basically occurs to me, why is it that someone can't immediately get to the root of the problem by probing this bank account that everyone's supposed to be putting their money into that's part of this hack? Because surely that would lead them immediately to the people who are behind it. Kevin, you first.
Now, again, there are all sorts of questions like that that need to be asked. Oddly, computer crime, in one sense, ought to be the easiest to detect, precisely how you have said. You can follow the trail. It doesn't get burnt. You know, it's there. It may be complicated, but it is there.
The banks will probably say, oh, well, I'm sorry, that information's confidential, when the police knock on the door or phone them up.
This is where you get caught in a contradiction about the police, you know, having these new powers to dive into anything they want and put surveillance on everything, but they don't seem able to use it when there's a crisis there. This is the real question. The powers are all there in the law. Why aren't they working?
I think the other thing is the police will say, well, it can take us weeks to get access to a bank to get all the correct approvals for them to tell us who, for example, the signatures are on this bank account where the people are being asked at the National Health Service right now to put money into that account, and yet the police can't find out probably for weeks who the signatories are and where the money would be then transferred to.
Yeah, but again, that's an excuse I've never understood. If the police have, a drug suspect, something more obvious, they get a warrant from a magistrate in 4 hours. Mm. What's the problem with
Martin, what do you make of this? Let's just try and grapple with this story that's in the news today.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, there's nothing wrong with legitimate law enforcement being able to find out whatever they need to find out, you know, hard drives, whatever they need to look at. But this general surveillance of the population to stop terrorism is I mean, we've already got all the powers that the police need to investigate crime already exist. They've been on the statute book forever. They don't need extra powers. That's absurd. And, of course, Theresa May is very much part of one of those that's been pushing for extra powers to prevent terrorist attacks and so on. Now, of course, the real problem is that the terrorists may be inside the structure, as we're going to discuss in a moment about what's been going on in Germany. And the real problem there is not the powers of the police to investigate. It's that they don't want to investigate because the people they're investigating are too powerful and are able to tell them to back off.
Yeah, further up the chain.
Okay, so, but, yes. Sorry, Kevin, go on.
No, Theresa May got the Investigatory Powers Act on the statute book. That act can't work. Mass surveillance that is included in the act, bulk collection, they call it, same thing, is a breach of the most basic rights in the European Charter of Human Rights. So, of course, her other plot is to take the UK out not only of the EU, but out of the European Council, the Council of Europe. And so that there's no... We, the people of Britain, are victims of this.
Let me just make it clear, because certainly the stuff I've read is that it looks like for at least the next 10 years, Britain will be staying in the European Court of Human Rights, but not in the European Court of Justice, which is the thing they've got the big beef with. For example, the European Court of Justice has just ruled that any employer can sack someone from wearing a headscarf. And they say it's not religious discrimination. So there are two different separate courts.
Yeah, no, they're totally... And most people don't understand the distinction. However, the court that convicted her American friends of mass surveillance and criminal activity was the European Court of Justice, not the Human Rights Court. The case never went there. No wonder she's anxious to get out from under it.
Sounds like a whole load of legal juggling just to get around the law. Anyway, let's get on to this German army calling for searches of all barracks after Nazi memorabilia is found. This is the head of Germany's armed forces called for an inspection of all army barracks after investigators discovered neo-Nazi military memorabilia in a garrison, broadening a scandal about right-wing extremism amongst soldiers. The discovery at a barracks in Dönitzschen Donaueschingen, I think that's probably the best way to say it, in southwest Germany made an investigation that began after similar Nazi-era items were found in the garrison of an army officer arrested on suspicion of planning a racially motivated attack. As a result, General Inspector Volker Wieker, he has ordered a wider search of barracks right across the country. So, Martin, this has also been sanctioned by Defence Secretary Ursula von der Leyen. She said the military must root out all right-wing extremism. And yet, this is actually very serious, isn't it? We're talking about not necessarily neo-Nazis, but Nazis. We're talking about soldiers who are venerating Hitler, actually serving soldiers right now within the German army.
Well, what interests me about this is what are the connections of this guy? I think the police have done a very good job to catch the individual, because he'd already stashed a pistol in Vienna Airport. The plan was that he was going to turn up, pick up this pistol, carry out an attack. The pistol would then be left and he would escape. And a big question in my mind, how would you escape? He must have had some means, because, of course, if he was arrested on the spot red-handed, then they wouldn't have been able. And what he'd done previously is, as a serving German army officer, he'd gone and pretended to be a Syrian asylum seeker, given his fingerprints to the the people that deal with these things, so that it would then appear to be an asylum seeker who'd carried out the attack. And, of course, he then would have escaped from Vienna Airport and presumably his thing would not have been traced. Now, in other words, he would have been protected. Now, we know similar things have happened in Germany in the past. So, for example, a few years ago, there were assassinations of various Turkish shopkeepers and so on. And the way it was investigated by the police was that it was some kind of internal feud in the Turkish community. And it was eventually uncovered that these assassinations, 10 or 12, had been carried out by neo-Nazis and had been protected by the BND, the German intelligence services. And, of course, this fits a pattern going back decades of Western intelligence services being involved in false flag terrorism.
Well, von der Leyen said the military had not taken the threat of right-wing extremism seriously enough. She says you have reason to dig deeper to the military. She said, noting that 18 members of the armed forces had been dismissed for right-wing extremist views since 2012. But, Kevin, this is we have not been told his rank, but he was an officer who managed, with others, they believe, to squirrel away at least 1,000 rounds of ammunition.
Yeah, if you're in a military force, officer or any other rank, it's not that difficult. The problem with... One of the post-war crimes against the population of Europe, media-type crimes, was the division of the German army into the bad Wehrmacht and the bad SS and the good Wehrmacht. If you were a Russian, they were all the same. They were all fascists because they murdered most Russians they ever met.
So they weren't very good at treating Russian prisoners of war well,
no.
Were they?
And this was the Wehrmacht. This wasn't the SS. So the German army is still contaminated from World War II, but I see the
isn't
hand
it, I mean,
of...
Isn't it about time that the German army surrendered to the Russians? Because they refused to do that at the end of the Second World War, Martin, didn't they? They surrendered to the Allies, that is the British and the Americans, but they never did to Moscow.
Yeah, I think there's...
No, can I correct you? Do you
Sorry?
Mind?
I'm not quite sure.
The person who translated the German surrender in Berlin was a man called Boris Brattes, a friend of mine. He was Zhukov's translator. And from when we were at college, we didn't know who he was. But he gave us, he had a photographic memory, and he gave us the German surrender word for word.
Oh, so they
no,
did.
The Germans did surrender to the Russians
okay.
in Berlin.
I think maybe I'm getting a bit confused with the Japanese, Singapore maybe, something like that.
Who never surrendered to the Russians. Yes, they have never. There's a ceasefire, but no peace treaty.
And also, of course, the situation we'll be coming on to a bit later with North and South Korea, Martin.
Yeah, well, there is no... Yeah,
but
there's just a ceasefire there.
I probed I suspect that the sudden urge to clean up the German army is coming from Merkel. Merkel has realised there's a problem. It's taken her a while to wake up, I think. But there is a problem.
Can I just say, and it's not just that the German army has got the recidivist Nazis in it. what worries me is that this is part of a general pattern of Western intelligence services, not just the German intelligence services, also MI6 and the CIA, of fomenting both right-wing and left-wing terrorism. Just think if this guy had managed to succeed in what he wanted to do. He's carried out an attack in Vienna Airport. He's killed loads of random tourists. He's escaped. And, of course, the word goes out that this is another terrorist attack by these evil Muslims from Syria, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it may well be that the previous attacks that we've seen are of exactly this kind.
Exactly. We heard last week, Martin, didn't we, about the Dortmund bus attack actually being done by somebody who was actually just a criminal who was trying to make money, not a terrorist at all. They're just an ordinary criminal.
Well, also, I'd like to mention, if we're going to mention Dortmund, the Dortmund Beer Hall massacre in 1980, which the police eventually uncovered was actually carried out by NATO intelligence services as part of Operation Gladio. Now, we know, because we've had decades of investigation of this, that NATO intelligence services routinely engage in terrorist activities. The bombing of Bologna railway station, again in 1980, Italian police absolutely convinced that was carried out by NATO. The same NATO that Theresa May thinks that we've absolutely got to be a part of, otherwise Jeremy Corbyn will prevent us from being part of it, and so on and so forth. People need to know the history of NATO. NATO is, as Donald Trump said, obsolete, except he's changed his mind
What do you make of NATO, Kevin?
It's what it has always been. It's an instrument of the United States to create tension with Russia so the United States arms industry can sell arms to Europe. During the presidential campaign, the one thing that got the Americans panicked was when Trump was saying the NATO allies are going to have to start paying up. They already do. The biggest trade imbalance in the world is the military one, because most of the NATO forces buy American weapons. It's just a way of raising the tensions so that weapons are sold by the Americans to NATO.
I mean, this trade, this imbalance almost seems to be going alongside this social imbalance. That is, when we talk about equality a lot, we talk about all sorts of different types of sexual equality, this kind of thing, equal marriage. But we don't hear anywhere near enough, in my mind, about basic equality of income, where people do not have enough money to live on. Mm. We'll be hearing on Dialect on next Tuesday noon about the people who are having to live in tents, certainly not out of their own choice, here in Bristol today. And just getting back to the rich list again for a minute, Kevin, one of the things that has come out of that is that this year's 500 richest individuals and families are now wealthier than the entire top 1,000 were last year. So, you know, their wealth is increasing at exponential rates, while for the vast majority, for example, if you check this stuff out, that work is actually no longer a route out of poverty, according to the... I mean, we've got nearly two-thirds of children now living in poverty in working families, and most people classed now in poverty in Britain have got a job.
Yeah, what Theresa May is really demanding a strong mandate for is because she's going to have three huge problems. She's going to have the cost of Brexit and then the job losses. Then she's going to have the cost of the NHS, and then she's going to have the cost of social services, and she's going to want to be able to ignore all those three crises.
I mean, Martin, is what we're looking at here, slowly but surely in many countries right across the West, particularly after 2008, the idea that the state is not really needed or wanted, the idea that because it's so massively in debt, let's just push the state out of the way. I mean, that devalues our vote every year, doesn't it, if that is what's going on?
Well, effectively, when the state stepped in and bailed out the private financial markets in 2008, we basically gave them a blank check. Philip Mirovsky, the professor in the US, has written some very good stuff about this. And, of course, the reason why the wealthiest have had their wealth increasing so rapidly is because of this stock market bubble that's all based on money printing. And the money printing isn't being used to keep keep the poor in necessities. It's being used to build up asset prices so that the super wealthy can carry on raking it in. And, of course, it's going to crash. That's the other thing that's going to happen. It's not just because of Brexit. There's going to be a crash. It may start in Wall Street like it did last time. It'll be a US crash, not a European crash. It won't be to do with the euro. And we're all going to, and at that point, of course, what Theresa May hopes is she's going to...
You've been saying that for 8 years.
Well, yes, right? Because, of course, it only happens once. Like, yeah. But it's still... It's like building a bonfire in Northern Ireland. You just build a bonfire and build a bonfire and build a bonfire, and it only goes off when you put a match to it. And, of course, but that bonfire is definitely there. There is no basis for the stock prices we're now seeing. They're way above the normal price to earnings ratio that you would expect
market. What do you make of this phenomenon now where we hear from people like the Joseph Rowntree Trust, a great article on politics.co.uk, which the headline is "The Myth That Work Pays Is Finally Exposed." For many people, as soon as they get into work, they're also immediately suffering with the withdrawal of benefits. And nowadays, you've got to have probably two people in order to pay the rent and the bills in a house in a low paid job. It's really, really difficult to get not only to get your foot on the work ladder, but also on the housing ladder. It's almost impossible.
Again, there was no analysis at the time. It was quite clear in Thatcher's time that she wanted people back in rented accommodation because they are much more vulnerable than people. People who own their own homes have a certain stake and they're a bit bulgier and they've got something to lose. If you're in rented accommodation, you'll be fearful for your job. And this is the Tory fear programme. Make the public fearful, and then they can be manipulated so easily.
Yeah, I think that they certainly want to create fear. I think decent rented accommodation of council housing kind doesn't fulfil that. You know, that gave people a bit of security. People in private rented, I mean, basically, we are the taxpayers who are paying VAT on everything they buy are subsidising private landlords who are their own landlords. Yeah. And, of course, they're not actually getting anything from that at all.
Okay,
it's just free money from the government for the landlords.
Martin talks about the Spirit Level book on here quite a bit. And one of the authors of that is also the founder of something called the Equality Trust, Professor Kate Pickett. Now, there was a very rare appearance of her on the BBC recently on the Nikki Campbell programme. So let's have a listen to what Professor Kate Pickett has got to say about the inequalities today.
If I were the architect of universal credit and responsible for some of this welfare reform, I would not be sleeping at night. We should not be relying on charities to prop up our social security system. That's an opinion. Now I'm going to speak as a scientist. What we're seeing as a consequence of welfare reform is rising child poverty, and soon we're going to have one in four of all of our children living in poverty, two-thirds of them in houses where somebody works. We're seeing rising infant mortality for the first time in decades. We're seeing a rise in deaths among the frail elderly. Tens of thousands. Now, speaking as a citizen, I think we should be outraged at the immorality of those reforms. We should be piling up the body bags in those tiny infant coffins outside number 10 and number 11 Downing Street and making our Prime Minister and Chancellor walk that gamut every day. Because it's outrageous what we're doing. We are punishing the poorest. We are punishing the disabled, we are punishing the sick, and we are doing it at levels unseen of in this country since the end of the Second World War. We should be ashamed of what we're doing.
Well, obviously, I agree with that, and her book was very interesting because she wrote it with Richard Wilson, as they say, and what they show in that book is it's massively full of statistics and graphs, and it's an overwhelming argument. It was a bestseller because it points out that the more equal your society is, the better off everybody is, and they tentatively put forward a hypothesis for this. We are basically status-conscious animals. We're very conscious of our status in relation to others, and that's why more equal societies are much happier societies, because it's not just a question of poor people having the basics. If they've got the basics, but they're still not, they don't feel as if they can participate, then they get mentally ill, they get sick, and so forth. So, for example, children who go to school who can't afford to go on trips or to do the extra clubs and all the rest of it, they start feeling inferior, having health problems at that early stage. And another interesting fact from the book was in societies that are more equal, like Sweden or Norway, the wealthier are better off. because in actual fact they have less stress. They pay their taxes and then they feel good about themselves, and in actual fact they feel better off. But we've forgotten all of this because of the deliberate pursuit of inequality by the right wing.
I wonder, are we, and it's not us, if you like, but I wonder if this is the mistake Jeremy Corbyn is making. He seems to me to be slightly pitching his message at the, you know, underprivileged, those who are at the sharp, you know, at the rough end of things. Mm-hmm. But the people, the majority probably are well off. And maybe he should be turning it around and pitching to get them to join him in doing something about this rising poverty and...
Well, you know what's underpinning that? Is the electoral system. In Ireland, as you well know, you can't form a government unless you've got a pretty big consensus. So you can't do it. In Britain, because of the system that we've had for years, it's designed to entrench Tory governments. It's a few hundred thousand people in swing constituencies around London decide general elections. They don't decide them in France, they don't decide them in Germany, they don't decide them in Ireland, and in the future they won't decide them in Scotland either.
It looks as if we're coming back round again talking about the tax havens, and there is a film coming out soon. There's a trailer for it online, which I was watching last week. It's called The Spider's Web, Britain's Second Empire, which is the tax havens. So let's have a listen to a clip from the trailer now.
The reality is not what you believe, that your prime minister has the power to decide on the future of your country. The power is hidden here.
I had complete access to all the client files, and this is what I found. There were some insider traders, some market rigging, some avoiding disclosure of conflicts of interest, illicit arms trading, illicit political campaign donations, contract kickbacks, bribery, fraudulent invoicing, trade mispricing, and at the bottom, tax evasion.
If you come from the same kind of background, you know the right people, then all the kind of legal niceties will often fall away. You can get away with doing all sorts of things.
That's a clip there from the forthcoming film, which is called The Spider's Web. And we heard there, Martin, from John Christensen, and he's talking about all the various types of transactions that were going on where he was working in the Channel Islands for effectively a kind of tax evasion, tax avoidance company, some sort of accounting job. But he could see the money was going to all these sorts of illicit purposes, including things like dodgy arms deals.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things, we've had some exposure of tax havens in recent years, but then again, there's manipulation going on there, because the Nevada is now becoming a major tax haven, and of course they don't get the scrutiny that the British tax havens are getting. So there's a kind of attempt to make some tax havens sound bad and other tax havens are less so.
Yeah, we don't hear a lot about Switzerland either, which is a massive tax haven, Kevin. Yeah.
Well, the United Kingdom, in effect, is also a tax haven itself, you can. But mentioning Second Empire and tax havens, I think if you saw Who Owns the World, that was one of the chapters in it, was that Britain has this peculiar structure where a great deal of the world's cash is. You've touched on this a couple of times yourself. The City of London needs the tax havens for the cash.
Yeah.
And they're all headed by the Queen.
Sorry, who are?
Most of our tax havens.
Oh, the tax havens, yeah.
Crown dependencies.
Yes, that's right. And she's responsible for appointing all the people to govern these places. So she's in quite a good position to maybe do something about the tax havens. The only trouble is she avoiding tax?
Well, since unfortunately, unlike... One of the good things about the rich list is at least we know who they are. So if we really wanted, we could talk to these people. In the case of the Queen, her status has been completely hidden. We don't know. The only thing we know she owns is the Crown Estate, because the Tories gave it to her when they became the coalition government.
But yet that is not included in the rich list. What?
No.
Why is that?
Well, it appears that prior to that, the Palace had phoned Murdoch.
Yeah, so they managed to get it out, but even now it should be in, it's still not there. I mean, it sounds like the Queen's got quite a lot of... but anyway, you were kind of dodging my question a bit. Is the Queen got a lot of money in tax havens?
Well, as she owns quite a few of them, wouldn't it be a surprise if she didn't?
Okay. All right. So also then, let's have a listen now also to, on a similar theme, this is a clip from a while back, actually, but it kept popping up into my mind. It's talking to somebody that Martin and I have known through the 9/11 Truth movement. His name's Justin Walker, and he's the nephew of one of the directors of the Bank of England back in 1972 by the name of Harry Pilkington. And Harry gave Justin some advice as a young lad. Let's have a listen to that. This is Justin telling us about that a couple of months ago.
My journey started back in 1972. I was going back to school. I was on a train. I was with my uncle, and he was Sir Harry Pilkington, later Lord Pilkington. He went to the very first Bilderberg conference in 1954. I didn't know that until only a few years ago. But I did know he was the director of the Bank of England from 1955 to 1972. And this was 1972, and he was actually travelling down to London to go to one of his last meetings at the Bank of England. We were just talking about general subjects when he suddenly stopped me dead and said, what are you doing when you leave school? And I was only 16, and I was going down to do my O-levels and stuff. And he said, I'm going to give you two pieces of advice to take through life. First of all, never believe anything you read in the press, because we control it. And secondly, never, ever believe a politician when they say they can do something, because they can't unless we say they can.
Well, that's a bit damning, Martin. I mean, I suppose people will point the finger at Justin Walker and say, oh, well, he's a 9/11 truther, he's a conspiracy theorist.
Well, that may be... that's frankly true. So's Donald Trump, but he's the President of the United States. And on that point, of course, Trump on the day of 9/11 actually said, well, because I build these buildings, there must have been bombs in the buildings.
Let's get back to the point here, which is the Bank of England. He's saying they're controlling press and also controlling political parties.
Well, the question that comes to mind when I hear that quote is, who's we that he's talking about? Because it isn't we.
The Bank of England. He's talking about the city.
No, I don't think he's talking about the city of London.
Okay. I'd say he's talking about the establishment.
Yeah, in a more general way.
Okay, so obviously the establishment includes the Bank of England. Yeah. Where else? Maybe the monarchy?
The monarchy in particular. Because the monarchy was intimately involved in the creation of the tax havens. They kind of grew up amongst courtiers. You know, they needed somewhere to stash a few illicit pounds. And what better than, you know, Jersey or the Bahamas or wherever. So... but the establishment, as what was it, Anthony Sampson defined it, would be the Bank of England, the security services. They're big in the equation. And, of course, have you noticed our media reporting that GCHQ is now in the hands of MI5? Nobody seemed to notice. The deputy head of MI5 has just become the head of GCHQ. The chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee, which would be central to what Pilkington was warning about, tried to defend American spying in Britain in an affidavit. We're not talking about opinions here or conspiracy theories. This guy put in an affidavit to court saying, well, it was legal in America, so it was okay here. No, actually, it isn't. The laws that apply here are ours.
Martin, I mean, anyone listening to that will think, well, what's the point in voting, you know, if the press and politicians are all owned by the establishment?
Well, there is an issue. I mean, there have been various attempts to, you know, in Northern Ireland, for example, to boycott. But of course...
We're trying to encourage young people to register to vote here. In fact, we'll put a link up on our show page.
The only thing I would say is this, that not voting doesn't achieve anything. Voting doesn't achieve much, but not voting will achieve nothing at all. So let's get clear about this. Just coming back to the whole tax haven thing, what Philip Hammond was hinting was that if we don't get a good deal on Brexit, whatever that means, we might turn Britain into a tax haven, which it already is. And, of course, the response from Merkel to that was, don't try and threaten us. And, of course, when and if Angela Prime Minister Theresa May tries to negotiate with the European Union leaders, if she tries that kind of tactic, if you don't give us a good deal, we're gonna just let rip on having tax havens in Britain. Their response to that is, no, you're not. We're going to close you down, and we'll get a terrible deal on things like car imports and so on and so forth. And threatening people before you negotiate them, it is part of a negotiating tactic. But of course, the Republican movement in Northern Ireland are going to be threatening you from behind, and of course, so are the Scottish National Party.
No, but there's a more immediate. The president of the European Commission is the arch tax dodger himself, a Juncker. He signed more dodgy tax deals when he was Prime Minister of Luxembourg than probably all our tax havens ever did. He was the master of the tax dodge. So why do we expect him to do anything spectacular about... My hunch would be that he's a bit worried, because Luxembourg was part of the structure of tax-dodging tax havens.
The German tax police did invade Luxembourg, didn't they, a few years ago? They just turned up mob-handed and went through all of their hard drives, because it's only a tiny little country. And ultimately, of course, what General de Gaulle did with Monaco in 1962 is, he knew that lots of people were using it as a tax haven, so he just sealed the border with the military and said, nobody's coming in or out of Monaco until you tell us how much money you've got. And I think when the murd hits the fan, as it will, as I've suggested, governments are going to get much more serious about collecting their taxes. They'll have to. That'll be very much part of what has to happen.
OK, let's run through some of the international stories now, just quickly, both of you. First of all, Syria doctors apparently are crowdfunding underground hospitals over there. That is to say that they're putting out appeals online for people to crowdfund hospitals inside Syria. Now, Kevin, this seems a bit of a desperate measure. Is it? It's strange that the international aid agencies are having so much difficulty actually getting help through to Syria.
Now, Syria is one of the most complicated areas, as I understand the few people I've met who've been there. To get any kind of aid through is a nightmare. It's worse than most places. But I missed this. Is it the aid agencies are crowdfunding?
This is the source
of the report.
The doctors themselves, actually, over in
in Syria. Are the doctors in the government-controlled areas, or the doctors in the rebel-controlled areas, like the White Helmets?
Several heavily populated parts of the country, hospitals have repeatedly been damaged and some sites destroyed outright. Obviously, repairs are constantly underway, but doctors in the same parts of the country have come up with a novel solution, relocating underground. Hama has one of the earliest and best examples.
That's under the rebel control.
Okay.
Now, in actual fact, we've got sanctions on Syria. We, the British, have got sanctions on Syria along with lots of other countries, which means, of course, that 90% of the population are in government-controlled areas, and they have real problems because we won't supply them with any drugs or any help of any kind. That's one of the things that the Syrian people have to put up with. This is another manipulation, because crowdfunding says, isn't it terrible, they've got to have crowdfunding in Syria. Now, in actual fact, the White Helmets are a psychological warfare operation run by the Western Intelligence Service.
They're also in Idlib province as well.
That's another rebel-controlled area. So in other words, we're talking about in rebel-controlled areas, the Russians are bombing hospitals deliberately, although there's been no evidence to suggest that, and now they're having to crowdfund. How awful is that? Now, 90% of the population are in government-controlled areas. The White Helmets are a psychological warfare operation. The Swedish Doctors for Human Rights...
The origin of the story is actually The Guardian.
The Guardian will have got it from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is actually a British-funded individual living in Coventry who hasn't been inside Syria in the last 20 years. There's an awful lot of lies and nonsense talked about what's been going on in Syria. Mm. And the fact is that Syria is under siege by the NATO powers and the Gulf states. And millions of people have been displaced, and hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. And this is actually a war crime. And of course, James Le Mesurier, who set up the White Helmets, is based in Turkey. He's a British psychological warfare operations officer, and his funding all comes from the British government. We pay for this. And the Swedish Committee of Human Rights, they're all doctors. They've analysed the videos put out by the White Helmets and say, not only are the White Helmets not helping children in these videos, they're actually murdering children in these videos and pretending to help them. That's what we fund. And, of course, we're going to war with Syria if Theresa wins the election. But, of course, it's not going to be a pushover. They're going to fight back, and they're going to fight back hard. They've taken hundreds of thousands of casualties in the Syrian army, and let's just see how the British army can face up to that.
Well, so it's interesting the Guardian isn't really saying which areas these are in, but, yeah, you're quite right, Martin. It's in rebel-held areas. The Guardian is saying
the information from the British psychological warfare officers.
We should be crowdfunding these hospitals, the rebel-held. But mind you, of course, you know, anyone that's been killed or injured on any side should be being given help of some sort. Southern Yemen leaders, we hear today also, are launching a body seeking a split from the north. Senior tribal military and political leaders have formed a new council seeking secession of southern Yemen. The former government of the area's main city, Aden, said on Thursday, threatening to bring more turmoil to a two-year-old civil war. The announcement was made on a televised address in front of the flag of the former nation of southern Yemen. Now, it was 1994, there was a war, and the forces were defeated by the north and brought into a reunified country, but apparently it's time to divide it again now.
Well, Kevin probably has some comment to make about this, because this is your military career back in the 60s, isn't it? I mean, southern Yemen used to be a Marxist state.
That's right.
And, of course, then the north invaded the south and they became a single state. And
Kevin. Yeah.
But the civil war there was between factions within the country. And one of my lads once said to me, he said, you know, we're being told all these guys are Marxist rebels. He said, they're the first Marxists I've ever seen say their prayers five times a day. So it's...
What do you make of this move to split Yemen up again, then, into north and south?
If it stopped the civil war, it would help, but I can't see it doing that.
No, I can't see it doing that either. And one of the things Jeremy Corbyn has pledged to do is stop supplying British weapons to Saudi Arabia, which are, in fact, Saudi Arabia is the most terrorist-inclined country in the world. There's no doubt about it that wealthy Saudis are the main funders of Wahhabi, Salafi, Takfiri terrorism in Syria and elsewhere. And they are our allies, and we work with them every day. And we are going to war with Syria if Theresa May wins the election with Donald Trump. But we're not necessarily going to win, because it looks like the Russian Air Force and the Russian military are actually superior to our military, because they're fighting for the right. I'm not a pacifist. You're fighting for the wrong. You expect it. And we were mentioning earlier about the Marine in Afghanistan. Helmand province is now 100% under the control of the Taliban. So every British life lost to try and take that province back from them was a life wasted.
Kevin, yeah. As someone that served in Yemen, what do you make of the present situation there? Any thoughts about how to sort it out with the blockade going on and the bombardment by Saudi Arabia?
This is in Yemen. Again, a ceasefire is absolutely essential. But can I take you just a tiny step? Trump is a lunatic, but he made a promise that, unfortunately, he would be able to keep, given American military power. He can defeat IS. But he needs the Russians to help him. I'm switching you from Yemen to Syria. But it's a promise that he can deliver. And this is very unsettling. And a lot of people are going to get killed if he heads down that road. But he needs the Russians. So his kind of rapprochement with Russia actually made sense, more sense than his brain suggests. Very odd.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the whole geopolitical situation is in flux. But, Saudi Arabia invaded Yemen, effectively, and also invaded Bahrain during the Arab Spring. Now, when you cross international borders, like Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait, you then have a question, well, why is this being allowed? Why isn't somebody doing something about this? Not only are we not doing something about it, we are supporting. There are British military personnel based in Saudi Arabia today helping the Saudi military, who are all trained at Saudi Sandhurst yeah. to kill civilians in Yemen. Now, I'm not a pacifist. Maybe some fighting has to be done. And maybe some British soldiers have to die. Just like in Afghanistan, where they shot that boy that we were talking about earlier. He was braver than many of the British soldiers who were there.
We've also heard from Jeremy Corbyn, haven't we, today, that he's not a pacifist either.
No. Who's a pacifist? Apart from Jesus Christ. And, of course, the fact is that we are on the brink, potentially, of a nuclear war, and we haven't really got round to discussing North Korea yet.
We're doing that any minute now.
But the danger is that we're in a... You know, when we're talking about whether Jeremy Corbyn would use nuclear weapons first, and his answer, of course, is no, I wouldn't. But, of course, the threat made by Britain and America that they would use nuclear weapons first, and that they've deployed anti-missile systems in Romania and Poland, if you were the Russian general staff, you'd be preparing for nuclear war. Mm, yeah. Of course you would.
Well, let's talk about North Korea now. As Martin mentioned there, North Korea has accused the CIA of trying to assassinate Kim Jong-un with biochemical substances. The government statement claims the leader targeted during a public ceremony in Pyongyang. I mean, is this credible, do you think? Maybe you first, Martin?
Well, the idea that the Americans might assassinate people they don't like, they assassinate their politicians, US politicians they don't like, so that if they thought they could get away with it, they would. But the idea that killing this individual at the head of the North Korean structure would end the conflict is absurd. I mean, the North Koreans lost 20% of their population to Allied bombing during the 1950s. They are pretty, they don't have to have much provocation to fear what we may or may not do to them.
Also, Kevin, China is telling its citizens to leave North Korea as tensions with the US escalate. The embassy reportedly calls Korean Chinese residents with a warning.
Yeah. Trump is a loose cannon, and so is the guy in North Korea. It's a bad combination. And the Chinese will try and cool it. So that's what we should be looking for.
Well, Martin, it looks as if definitely the Chinese are sending signs to the world that they're not prepared to back North Korea in an unlimited way. There's also reports, this is from North Korea. North Korea say they could destroy the world with just 3 bombs. That's a regime apologist claiming that. Reclusive States self-styled special delegate says Korea is perfectly prepared with nuclear and thermonuclear weapons. This is an article in the Independent. Is there any truth to that, do you think, that North Korea could destroy the entire world with just 3 or 4 thermonuclear bombs?
Anybody who starts a nuclear war, even a minor nuclear war, there's going to be consequences. What's fascinating to me about this situation is the deployment of this so-called THAAD system in South Korea. Because, of course, it's actually designed, just like the missiles in Romania and Poland, for a first strike on China. It wouldn't actually work to try and stop North Korea because the missiles...
So are all these missiles defensive?
No, they're not.
Told.
They're not defensive. Okay. They're not perceived to be defensive by the Chinese general staff or the Russian general staff. But what's happened in the election, the presidential election in South Korea, is a moderate candidate has won, and he's saying, well, actually, we don't want this system. It doesn't protect us. But, of course, he's got to try and keep on Trump's right side. I wish the newly elected president of South Korea every luck. He's going to need it because he's got to make Trump and Kim Jong-il see sense. And, of course, the Chinese, obviously, they want sense as well. But this is all about creating tension with China and Russia. Ultimately, that's what we mentioned earlier, what drives Western policy. It's driven by armaments sales. That's what it's about. And, of course, the danger with that is you end up fighting China and Russia rather than just getting loads of new weaponry to pretend to fight them, because wars have a horrible tendency to just spiral out of control once you've started them.
If you read Private Eye last week, real war would be a catastrophe for us because we've got about enough aeroplanes to fly for about 3 days. We have got...
Well, backing North Korea pretty much is China. And as I said at the top of the hour, on Dialect next Tuesday at lunchtime, we'll be hearing some pretty horrific things about what's going on in China, with prisoners of conscience having their organs taken out of their bodies and sold by the Chinese government. And let's have a listen now to investigative journalist Ethan Gutman. His book called The Slaughter, simply The Slaughter, is about this subject. We can hear more about this next week at noon on Tuesday on Dialect.
It represents a level of medical corruption that we have not seen since the Holocaust. A level of medical experimentation and the willingness to use lives this way. Now we have an ability to turn us into $200,000 and $300,000 worth of profit. That's what we're worth. It's not only real, it is state-sponsored. It is run by the Chinese government. And it does not just use regular prisoners, rapists, murderers, the like. It uses prisoners of conscience. We've reached a state of evidence. Now, if you are going to China right now to get an organ, chances are a perfectly innocent person is dying for you. 65,000 people over 8 years, political prisoners. It uses this massive prisoner population, particularly Falun Gong, as a source for organs. This is the only country where this is truly legal. This is it. China. Now, this is something we all want to neglect. We all want to turn our eyes away. We're not going to stop trading with China. We're not going to. China is going to be a player in the world. How do we square the China we know with what I've just told you? It is like finding out a relative of yours is a child molester. Now, you may have known they had some problems before, but now you know they're a child molester.
The reports into this estimate between 60,000 and 100,000 organs are transplanted each year in Chinese hospitals. This is done mostly for money. Martin, it sounds pretty horrific, especially when the people being targeted for it are people of faith and they're being told either you renounce that faith or we're going to take your organs and sell them.
Well, I know that in actual fact that they're talking about prisoners here. It's not necessarily political prisoners.
What they're saying in this report is it's prisoners of conscience.
Well, that's what they're saying. And yes. I'd also say that there's if you go to Latin America, you can buy organs that have been harvested. There's evidence that the Israeli occupation forces have done this in the West Bank. And I have to say that this kind of anti-Chinese propaganda.
Well, it's not propaganda. It's happening, isn't it?
Well, I'm not saying that it isn't happening. I'm just saying it's interesting that we're now talking about it now. Don't forget, you've got 1 billion people in China, so 65,000 transplants a year, or hostile transplants, or whatever. I'm not saying that there isn't some evidence there. The Chinese state is not entirely a blameless structure. Of course it isn't. But then the US state isn't entirely blameless structure either. Why are we talking about this now?
Well, we're talking about it because I came across some people in the city centre here in Bristol who are concerned about it, and I think everyone should be concerned about it. Anyway, let's have a listen to Kevin.
No, it's I would be inclined to think about what Martin is saying because, if you like, I've got something, and it's not based on any conspiracy theories. It's very simple. And why are the American media not reporting it? It doesn't make any kind of sense.
Well, it might do if you
it does if yourself, Pilkington.
If you think to yourself, well, this is something that might be used as part of a psychological warfare campaign if there is kind of conflict breaks out. Finally, North Korea says it has the right to ruthlessly punish captured American citizens. There are at least 4 US citizens detained by North Korea, and they're saying they're going to punish them ruthlessly, Martin.
Well, there's clearly, there's an awful lot of propaganda going on all sides here, and everybody's ramping up the rhetoric. I think people need to actually think about the history of the original Korean War. It wasn't all one-sided. The West involved in massive atrocities against the population of both North and South Korea. 1 in 5 of the North Korean population was killed by indiscriminate Allied bombing carried out by the RAF and others. The North Koreans are not necessarily disposed to think of us as the good guys.
Yep. The volume of propaganda involved, it's very difficult to find out what is the truth.
Okay, so, I mean, what I'll do is I'll put a link up to this Australian news report, because the Australians seem to be rather more concerned about the organ harvesting than we do in Britain. And also, of course, there's a massive industry of organ tourism, which we go into on Dialect on Tuesday at noon. If you'd like to hear more about that, do tune in on BCFM 93.2. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf. Thanks to our guests in the first hour That was Mike Campbell from Protect Our NHS, also to Sunday Times Rich List journalist, former Sunday Times Rich List journalist and author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Carhill, and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1994. Yes, it's Johnny Violence. Do please join us at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips, and today I'm joined by Toby Blomé and Eleanor Levine of Code Pink. Our topic will be drone warfare. We'll be hearing audio clips from the recent documentary National Bird. This film looks at the mental toil of the drone program, takes on young Americans who fly these remote controlled aircraft or are involved in the program. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips, and joining me in studio today is Toby Blomé and Eleanor Levine of Code Pink. Welcome, Toby. Welcome, Eleanor.
Thank you for having us, Peter.
For the next hour, we'll be telling you about your work opposing drone warfare, and we'll also listen to audio tapes from the recent documentary film National Bird. National Bird presents interviews with three former people involved as researchers in the drone program who describe their jobs and the effect that the work had on their lives. In the film, they identify by their first names only. And so also both Toby and Eleanor, you've been recently at Keach Air Force Base and were involved in protests down there in Nevada. Can you tell us why and what happened there?
Sure, Peter. Creech Air Force Base is just north of Las Vegas. It can be thought of as the heart of the U.S. drone assassination program. It's where a lot of the assassination is taking place around the globe, including the assassination orchestrated by the CIA. And so we went down to Creech for our third annual big gathering. People came from all of the United States. There were at least 10 different states covered, including as far away as Wyoming and Wisconsin and Illinois. And We were there for a whole week of peace encampment, and this is an ongoing struggle that we've been doing since 2009, resisting drone assassination. And it was a huge success, measured in many different ways. In particular, we had a big day of mass action, trying to interrupt business as usual on the base. And it was very successful in the entrance to the where most of the traffic goes in. We had a big, very powerful action of some brave activists standing in the roadway blocking the airmen as they went into the base. They held tombstones, symbolic tombstones of the children who've been killed by U.S. drones with their ages. And one by one, they were carted off by Las Vegas police to vehicles and taken down to the Las Vegas jail. That was one effort of interrupting business as usual on the base. But we also had a small group that were down the highway about 10 miles from the base that did something that was kind of in uncharted territory. We did something new this year. We actually decided to block the highway, a small group of us, because at least 75% of the traffic goes into Creech Air Force Base. And we successfully held the traffic back for an extended amount of time. We slowed it down first and then brought big banners, shut down Creech, and another large, very huge banner that said, drone pilots, please refuse to fly. And it's going to be a big unknown what happens to the... Ultimately, we repeated that similar action the next morning to the surprise of the Las Vegas police even further down the highway. And there are ultimately three of us that were arrested and seven arrested on Wednesday morning at the main gate. And we are continuing our persistence. And there are many other things that happened that week. I'm hoping Eleanor will talk about some of them.
Eleanor, add in a little bit what happened.
We also had two showings of the film National Bird, which P has referred to and is from which she's going to play some clips. And in addition, we had a demonstration or protest in front of Trump International Hotel, which is just off the Strip in Las Vegas. And the reason we had the protest there wasn't so much to protest Trump, but because the hotel represents the belly of the beast. That the hotel represents or is emblematic of the concentration of wealth in this country and the concentration of power that's increasing and which marks the divide between the very wealthy and the increasing number of people who have very little in our country. It was very successful. A lot of people stopped by to talk to us, and a lot of the media came by to talk to us. And so it was a successful event.
That sounds really important, this film, National Bird, at what you're going to be playing clips of today. And we're in Fun Drive, so I want to point that out right now to everybody. And we're very excited because we had a North Bay person contribute a match of $500 to kick us off for today. So, David in Santa Rosa, thank you very much. The DVD, National Bird, is an hour and a half long program. It's the most terrifying quiet moments, of what's going on is this deep, multi-layered look at America's drone wars and a strategy, how that's become part of a global strategy since 9/11 and the numbers of innocent victims that are impacted. And we will hear from three of the whistleblowers that were part of that drone program telling us what's really going on. We also have the Assassination Complex, which is Jeremy Scahill's book on the drone program and the deliberate assassination of people around the world, including American citizens. So the DVD is a $110 pledge. The book is a $90 pledge, both for $180. And so if you're available to call us right now at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, we're going to play a clip from this film, and we hope that you will call us and kick us off right now. Let's start early in our program. Let's get this match out of the way. Every dollar you give will be a dollar, $2 to the station, and we'd like you to do that. So you're going to hear the voice of Heather. She's the first of three operators and researchers with the drone program, and we meet in National Bird, telling us what she did in the drone warfare program and how that work has changed her life.
You were omniscient in people's lives, and you literally just kind of hover over their area.
sometimes you would watch them for days, and then you'd have intel that this guy is a bad guy, and you would wait until he walked out to the field to meet with some friends for something, and you'd blow him up. Drop a hellfire missile on him. I originally was interested in the Navy at first because the guy that I was dating had been in the Navy, and I was like, oh, maybe I'll just join the Navy and, you know, travel and see the world and fight for my country and protect people from terrorists. And I ended up being recruited into the Air Force because I actually saw the posters with the drones, and I was like, wow, that is so cool, like unmanned aircraft, like that's really badass. And I was still like under the impression that America was saving the world, like that we were big brother and we were helping everyone out. So when I saw this possibility that I could get out of like the small town that I was in and get out of Pennsylvania and just travel, and I thought that was the only way to do it. It was like slow motion. And it was like you're watching someone just drag themselves across the field. When you watch someone in those dying moments, what their reaction is, how they're reacting and what they're doing, it's so primitive. It's really raw, stripped down death. That's what it is. This is real. Like, this isn't, it's not a joke. I have specific memories of many of them that I know I killed, but it's so messy, and like, they don't report it down to us who we killed. Maybe we killed our objective, maybe we killed a guy who we thought was our objective. We don't know. And I can say the drone program's wrong because I don't know how many people I've killed. After we would do a strike, and I would ask for a break and like go outside and smoke a cigarette and just think and like try to decompress and just try to push the like idea that I was involved in killing people out of my mind and like try not to think about it. Sometimes if I couldn't really get out of the situation for very long, I would just go to the bathroom and just sit on the toilet, like just sit there in my uniform and just like cry and just think about like what I was doing. It was just different emotional responses. I mean, a lot of times afterwards, I would feel just empty, and if I was crying, it was because I just didn't know how to stop feeling like that, how to stop feeling like a shell. And it was an empty void. And it was like always shaking after we would do strikes, because it's such an adrenaline rush. You're killing someone. You see someone die because you said it was okay to kill them. I was an imagery analyst and a screener. My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, the live video, of course, and identify everything. Another remote duty station, you'd have the pilot, of course, who's flying the actual aircraft, and the sensor operator who is moving the camera around. They were the ones that actually push the button. I do not push the button. I just identify what necessitates a button pushing. The bomb hit, and wait for it to cool down a little bit, and then you can see, like, the body parts. You can identify, like, that could be the lower half of his body, and that could be a leg. And then sometimes you'll stick around and watch family come and get them, or, like, pick up the parts and put their family member in a blanket, and a couple people hold onto a corner of the blanket and carry him back to their compound. According to my mental health records, I was high risk for suicide because of the way I acted about my job. My psychologist called my first sergeant, and he recommended that I be possibly moved to anything that wasn't involving watching people die all the time. And the first sergeant said that our team was undermanned and that they absolutely needed me to work mission, so he would look into it, but never returned my psychologist's phone calls, never gave him any indications that I was going to be moved to a better job, and I obviously wasn't. I stayed doing that job until the last possible moment when they had to let me out process because I was actually getting out of the military. So I guess that's the cost of a human life, because the fact that I was on a suicide watch list and they still wouldn't allow me to do something else that might help me a little bit obviously didn't matter to the military, and that shows how much the Air Force cares about its intelligence troops.
That was the voice of Heather from the film National Bird. And she was a drone operator. It's a small unmanned aircraft flown by remote control. It's slow. It's light. It can stay airborne for many hours. Its video cameras keep watch over vast areas. Using satellite communications, drones fly over Afghanistan and are controlled from military bases in the U.S., often through Germany. And they're equipped with surveillance gear and many carry missiles. The National Bird interviews with Afghans or talks about family losses and people that are involved. And here we hear one of the people, Heather, who was involved in that and realizing that she was killing people. So one of the surprising things we find about National Bird in this film is these drone operators and researchers there, observers, are not necessarily career military people. They're young recruits, and they have what other options in their life. I mean, they're. What do you think about that? With me in studio is Toby Blome and Eleanor Levine. What do you think about these youthful people and the impact it's having on their lives?
I think, for me personally, it's a sign of how little the people in charge in the military value the human beings that are fighting these wars, and especially that they would put someone who is so young, some of them are just barely 18 or 19, in a position like that, doing things they haven't even evolved, fully matured as adults yet. And they're asked to do very criminal acts against their own upbringing by their parents, you know, respecting life. And they're brainwashed to believe that they're doing it for good reasons at first, but over time it takes a huge toll on them. And many of them are so injured psychically, it will take many, many years to heal from, if they ever are able to fully heal. And they're victims of this whole program and U.S. foreign policy. They're as much victims as the people who are sitting ducks on the ground that we're assassinating.
It saddened me. I'd like to add something. This is Eleanor. I'd like to add something. When we were at Creech just a month ago or a few weeks ago, there was a group of young people who came from some kind of Christian academy who stood across the highway from us, lining the road that enters the base at Creech Air Force Base, and they were shouting and waving signs saying, "Support our troops. We support our troops." But in fact, the best way for us to support our troops is to get the truth out and for people to see films like National Bird, hear Heather speak, hear the other two drone analysts and operators speak, and to really understand that supporting our troops means not putting them in harm's way, bringing the troops home, and explaining to the American public what the real cost, the psychological cost, not just the financial cost, of putting young people in the position of being killers before they're even allowed to drink legally. That just makes no sense.
And another conundrum of these young operators is that they're high security clearance. And so if they're having psychological problems, they can't go to a therapist unless a therapist has a security clearance as well. So that's quite troubling. And it doesn't seem to be offered very much in terms of what the military provides. Have you met some of these people? Toby Blum?
We have met several of them. One, Lisa Ling, lives in the Bay Area. We've had multiple conversations with her. A couple of the whistleblowers, not in this film, but have been in many other drone films, have actually joined us. Vets for Peace sponsored them to come down to Las Vegas and speak after the film showing of National Bird. And we got to hear their personal stories. And then they're so courageous to actually speak out. And what's really evident in the film, Daniel, one of the whistleblowers in the film that's represented, You can tell he's so traumatized. He wants to just be able to talk openly about what he was involved in. And because he's tied down to the agreements to keep the confidential military secrets away from the public, he's really conflicted inside. And that's another trauma that these, even the whistleblowers that came to Las Vegas, you can tell there's only so much that they are able to talk about, or they'll find themselves in jail very rapidly.
It's somewhat diabolical, and that's what I get from reading The Assassination Complex by Jeremy Scale. This is the inside the government secret drone warfare program. They don't want us to know the extensiveness of this, how many, literally thousands of people around the world are dying daily. The targeting practices, how the White House will say, okay, there's a chain of command, and the military will make a recommendation, and then they'll look for targets. And one of these operators was saying that she got a letter that said she had successfully identified 100,000 targets over a couple of years. And, I mean, so we're talking this massive assassination program. I don't think there's any other way to call it that. And that's assassination of people around the world who may or may not threaten the United States in any way. And I can't say anything else except the word diabolical. And it's our nation doing that. And young people being ripped into that and then recognizing the severity of what they're doing. So it's just, it's appalling to me. The more I've read about this and the more I've looked at it and thought about it, and we've interviewed Toby a few months ago, it's striking to me that our nation has reached this level of killing, just open assassination with no risk to Americans involved.
Well, this is a program which is designed to terrorize people both at home and abroad. It's a program which is designed to terrorize all of the people in the countries we're droning, and there are seven of them, Somalia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and probably left one out. Did I say Afghanistan? Anyway, there are seven countries that we are heavily droning, and the program is designed to terrorize the people in those countries so that they will be submissive, and that they will agree to any kind of program that the United States wants to institute. It is also the case that the drone program and our continuous warfare program is designed to intimidate and terrorize people in the United States. If you speak up now, for example, Desiree Farouse from Code Pink laughed at Jeff Sessions hearing. She was arrested. It doesn't take much these days to be arrested, so people are afraid to speak up. People are terrorized into the goal of the program is to terrorize even people here in the United States into submission. And much of the practice for this terror program is being waged against people in black and brown communities and other communities of color in the United States. We practice in those communities, and then we try it out in the broader population. And so this is really a program which is to instill fear in people abroad and fear in people at home so that they don't speak out and that they just become accustomed to continuous warfare so that fear is normalized and people will do whatever they're asked to do. It's scary.
And police around the United States are investing in drones. Drones can identify you, follow your cell phone. They can, supposedly observation only at this point in the United States. But the Assassination Complex book, it just shows a suburb, an aerial view of a suburb in any city in the U.S. and how we can all be targets.
And actually what was just revealed, there was a leaked military video that was taken from a U.S. drone over the coast of Florida that was just tracking boaters. So the military was doing their training using the public as practice targets. I've always assume that when we do our protests at Creech Air Force Base that the drones that are up in the air practicing are watching down at our moves. But to actually go into just communities and watch the public, it's a total violation. But more importantly, the fact that the U.S. military has these drones flying over other nations that we have no business being in and watching every move of people on the ground is an incredible violation on their sovereignty and on their right to privacy as human beings. How this ever was allowed to develop to the state it is shocking to me. We not only want the drone killing to stop, we want the global surveillance of the world to stop. The U.S. has no business to be the world's police.
KPFA is in Spring Fund Drive right now, and we're offering this vital documentary, National Bird, as a thank you gift if you make a pledge of $110. And supporting KPFA is one way to get this kind of information out to the general public. It's a vital way in keeping these airwaves alive. I mean, we're talking to people all across Northern California, Santa Cruz to Fresno, way up in the North Bay, all the entire Bay Area. And this voice of truth to power is a vital institution to support. And we really ask you to call 1-800-439-5732 to pledge right now. We have a $500 match on the table. Every dollar you pledge is doubled in value. The National Bird film is $110 donation. The book, The Assassination Complex by Jeremy Scahill, is $90. The two of them together are $180. And we really hope that many of you will call in right now to KPFA. I want to play another clip and let you hear more, but we need to see that phone line start to light up a bit and really ask you to help us in that capacity by calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or you can donate online at kpfa.org. But we ask you to do that right now. It's really important. Toby and Eleanor, why do you think KPFA is important?
Wow, it's the alternative voice. It is a show in which people like us are invited to talk about the truth, to talk about things that you cannot hear about and you cannot read about in the standard press. It is a program in which there is debate. There are alternative views, even in the alternative radio station of KPFA. And where else do you get the opportunity to hear this multiplicity of voices and opinions? It's wonderful.
I'd also like to add that KPFA, I feel, strongly has influenced me in becoming the activist I am. I've been listening to KPFA since the time I lived in the Bay Area for 30 years now, more than almost 40 years, actually. And I got very well educated by listening to KPFA, and I'm forever grateful. So we urge listeners to make as big a donation today as you can and support KPFA.
By calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-AKPFA, or you can do that online at kpfa.org. We ask for your help. We really need your help to keep this station alive, to keep the voices of truth to power out there and available, to have Toby and Eleanor be here with us in studio to be able to talk about what I've been calling the diabolical nature of drone assassinations. The United States, the assassination nation, that just doesn't ring true to me, and nor should it to you. And we have to point that out continually around this country. So the film is the National Bird. It's a 90-minute film. It's just barely been released. It features three young Americans who formerly worked for the U.S. military, and now they're talking about it. And we're going to hear a sound clip from one of them now. Well, Daniel describes his experience working for the Air Force and what happened right after he left the military.
Before I joined the military, I was well aware that what I was about to enter was something that I was against, that I disagreed with. I joined anyways out of desperation because I was homeless. I was desperate. I had nowhere else to go. I was on my last leg, and the Air Force was ready to accept me. the people who defend drones and defend the way that they're used, they always say, you know, they protect American lives by not putting them in harm's way. But what they really do is they just embolden commanders. They embolden decision makers because there is no threat. There is no immediate consequence. They can do this strike and they can potentially kill this person that they're so desperate to get and to eliminate because of how dangerous, potentially dangerous, they could be to the U.S. But if it just so happens that they don't kill that person or that some other people are involved in the strike and get killed as well, you know, there's no consequence for it. When it comes to high-value targeting, every mission is to go after one person at a time. But anybody else that's killed in that strike is just blanketly assumed to be an associate of the targeted individual. So as long as they can reasonably identify that all of the people in the field of view of the camera are military-aged males, meaning anybody who's believed to be of age 16 or older, they are a legitimate target under the rules of engagement. If the strike occurs and kills all of them, they just say that they got them all. People oftentimes get mixed up in the anti-drone movement, trying to say that we should just ground drones and we should just eliminate drones from our lexicon and never allow them to exist in this world. It's just too dangerous. And I don't necessarily agree with them because drones are going to be a part of our life here pretty soon. They're going to be, most likely, they're going to be doing things that we were only able to do with people in a plane before. It would be like dusting crops or planting seeds or doing humanitarian surveillance during floods and disasters to try and locate victims. You know, they're going to be there. But there's also that other dangerous side to them that makes war so easy and so convenient and so simple that the people who have access to this technology and access to this capability just say, well, why wouldn't I use this? It's too easy. The most disturbing thing about my involvement in drones is the uncertainty. If anybody that I was involved in kill or capture was a civilian or not, there's no way of knowing. Nobody ever thinks about speaking out against the government who's worked for them and hasn't considered what the possible consequences are. But I don't dwell on them because I don't want it to affect my voice. I don't want it to silence my words or to curtail my speech. I generally feel like they being the government, they being the Justice Department, they shouldn't hold that power over me, this ominous threat that they'll go after me in the same way that they've gone after so many people, especially since 9/11. When they arrived, it was actually just hours after I had turned in my badge and was finishing my last day. I had gotten home, was relaxing, had poured myself a drink, and somebody downstairs was knocking at the door, and immediately both people at the door, man and woman, shoved FBI badges in my face, pushed me inside into the kitchen, and immediately behind them came, I'd say, about 20 agents, basically all of them with pistols drawn, some wearing body armor. And at this point, I'm extremely scared. I didn't understand what was going on. Altogether, I think there might have been at least 30 to 50 agents in and out of the house at different points throughout the evening, taking photos of every room and of everything, searching for different things. Once they were done, they left. And I didn't even have a phone on me. I'm probably gonna get indicted and I'm probably gonna get charged with a crime. There's probably a real chance that I'll have to fight to stay out of prison. I think it's kind of funny, a little ironic too, because so far I'm probably the only adult male in my entire family, immediate and external, that has not been to prison.
That was Daniel, one of the three drone vets profiled in National Bird. He's also appearing in National Bird as Jesslyn Rodak, the attorney who helps defend government whistleblowers. One of the points she makes is that whistleblowers facing criminal charges can incur legal bills of millions of dollars or more, even before their cases go on trial. She really calls this a David versus Goliath situation. So we're in Fun Drive here at KPFA. This is Project Censored. With me in studio is Toby Blome and Eleanor Levine, both Code Pink activists who have been down at the Creech Air Force Base just last month and protesting there and blocking the entrance to the base. That's one of the main places drones are managed, where they're flown from all over the world. I'm looking at Jeremy Scahill's book, and one of the chapters is about Africa and the numbers of drone bases that are there or available there, both for observation and for killing people, and how that goes through. Most of these operations go through Germany. They go through the military base Ramstein in Germany that connects to the entire Middle East through satellite. And it's micro cable directly to Germany from Creech. That's a global surveillance system with the ability to assassinate and kill you. I can't think of anything in any way that needs to be addressed morally by the American people than this situation. And you can help address that situation by making it more public by calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Donate online to Project Censored. That's right. We are in Fund Drive, and we need your support. We need you to be actively engaged in supporting this station. You can pick up a copy of the DVD, National Bird, for a $110 pledge. I mean, that's less than $10 a month, folks. And you can put that on a credit card. You can get the book, The Assassination Complex, by Jeremy Scahill and the staff at The Intercept. That has a foreword by Edward Snowden, an afterpath by Glenn Greenwald. And it's really quite an amazing book. Edward Snowden writes, "These disclosures about the administration's killing program reveal that there's a part of the American character that is deeply concerned with the unrestrained, unchecked exercise of power. And there's no greater or clearer manifestation of unchecked power than assuming for oneself the authority to execute another individual outside of the battlefield context." That is certainly a solid statement by Edward Snowden about this book, about this DVD, and why Toby and Eleanor are here today in studio to address this. They've been the ones kind of on the front lines of challenging the military at the air bases around the country. And say a little bit more about the protests that are going on, the people involved, and where it's happening. Toby.
Yeah, there's been protests all over the country. In New York, there's a very strong ongoing resistance in upstate New York, where Hancock Air Base is. And many states around the country have regular weekly or monthly protests. And we're all kind of interconnected with each other. But what I think the public needs to realize is this expansion of this horrible thing called the drone program is happening so fast. And as an example, under the Bush years, the average strike was one strike in 50 days. Under President Obama, in his two terms, he averaged one strike in 5 days. So that's a 10 times increase. And now, in just a few months under President Trump, we have an average of 1.5 strikes per day. And this is out of control. And there, as far as I'm concerned, there should be thousands of people at Creech Air Force Base and these bases. Even in Beale, we have monthly protests at Beale, just north of Sacramento. You can contact East Bay Code Pink at gmail.com to find out more and join us. Every month we go up there for 2 days. We have an encampment because Beale, just in our backyard, is heavily involved in the targeted killing program. And two of the whistleblowers that are in this film were stationed at Beale, so they're coming from our backyard. And we when will the public rise up against this? Because are we going to wait until 1,000 people per day are murdered? When does it stop? Vast majority of people murdered are civilians. It's undeniable. The U.S. will not admit it, but all independent research shows the vast majority are civilians. And there was one study that was done that 28 out of 29 people were unintended targets. So we will continue our resistance. We need it to grow. We need to be stronger. And Eleanor said, you know, this thing is to terrorize us, to make us afraid. But I think that what's really important to remember is nonviolent action is the most powerful thing we can do. It helps gives us strength. And the military and the police, oftentimes they really don't know what to do with us because we're completely committed to nonviolence. And studies show that nonviolence is the way to create good permanent change in the world.
And I just want to emphasize a couple of things that it has to be said that the drone assassinations are just an example of extrajudicial killing. There is no jury. There is no opportunity to present your case. There is no way to protect yourself. The decision is made ahead of time about who's guilty or who we want to decide is guilty, and then the missile is fired and somebody is killed or maimed along with other innocent civilians. This is not a case of justice. The second thing I want to say is that we try very hard not to talk about use the term drone warfare, but rather drone assassination, because drone assassinations accurately describe what's going on. We're not at war with the seven countries that we are droning. It's an uneven killing field. We go out, the United States goes out, and it kills without authority. There is no war. It is only an assassination program. The third thing I want to say is that one of the reasons that it's hard to mobilize the American public against drone assassinations is that it's war at a distance. People, the drone operators, the drone analysts, and the rest of the team sit very far away from the targets that are being missiled to death. And the American public is being told that the separation, this geographic separation, makes our military safer. And in the end, it does not make our military safer, and it does not make our population any safer, because we have made so many enemies around the world, and especially in the countries in which we are droning. And these are people who are beginning to rise up. And many of these countries are now slowly, one by one, developing surveillance drone programs. And the chickens are going to come home to roost. We're going to find ourselves in a very sad and very scary situation.
One point that I remember you made a month ago was that we don't drone China. We don't drone Russia. Because these things fly so slow that, you know, an ordinary plane could shoot them down. But we drone people that don't have those kinds of defenses. We drone people on the ground who are poor.
Who are totally defenseless.
And are defenseless, exactly. And that makes it, you know, an overt assassination program. It's not warfare. They can't fight back. That's what's really amazing to me.
Yeah. These are countries where the technology just does not yet exist.
I had one vet for peace describe it as that these people are just sitting ducks on the ground, and that's exactly how it is. And if you take the time to watch this film, which you should, they actually go into Afghanistan and interviews some of the families and that have lost loved ones. And you hear the story of three cars that were targeted, all civilians. Many women and children were part of the 23 that were killed. And this is just one example of many of just total civilians being murdered. We need to rise up and stop this. That I can't live with myself without being involved to try to stop it.
Yeah, and there are so many lies that are told, as Toby said before, about how many intended targets are really identified. I think The Intercept at one point, you can find in The Intercept that it's only 1 out of 10 targets that's really the intended target. And this has to stop. People have to realize that it may be assassination at a distance, but it's still assassination.
So we kill one person, and several more die on average, who could be just neighbors, friends. That's more than assassination. That's murder. And on a scale that is almost unimaginable. And here we are telling people daily strikes around the world. And this is the United States of America with a Bill of Rights, with a Constitution, with a supposed democracy. And we're allowing this to happen. We can't allow this to happen. We have to stand up and say no. This is the Project Censored Show on KPFA, and I'm Peter Phillips. With me in studio is Toby Blomé and Eleanor Levine from Code Pink. We're talking about drone warfare, and we've been listening to audio clips from the documentary National Bird, which you can attain a copy of this DVD with a pledge of $110 to KPFA. Please make that pledge now by calling 1-800-439-5732. Your pledge helps keep KPFA going. You can hear these programs, Project Censored, Guns and Butter, Flashpoints, and many more by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or donate online at kpfa.org. We really ask you to make that support now. We haven't heard yet that we got that match. And we had a $500 match from David in Santa Rosa, and we hope that we can get that and more in the next 15 minutes we have left in this program. The corporate media tells you what politicians and generals say. At Pacifica and KPFA, we work to bring you the voices of activists and the whistleblowers. Their stories don't fit the pictures the general and politicians want to present, so the corporate media doesn't carry their voices. That's why we go directly to you, our listeners, for financial support. And this hour, you're hearing the voices of three drone whistleblowers and anti-drone organizers. And please show your respect and your support for this kind of programming by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. This is really a vital information package that's available here. The DVD National Bird, for a $110 pledge, the book, The Assassination Complex by Jeremy Scahill and the staff at The Intercept, Inside the Government's Secret Drone Warfare Program, for a $90 pledge. Both together are $180. We ask you to participate in telling the truth to the American public. I mean, thousands of people are hearing the station right now, hearing this message, and we need you to help continue that, to support KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732. We want to go to a third clip here from the DVD. This is a clip from the National Bird, and we're going to hear Lisa and her parts of interview from the film after leaving the military, and she decided to, why she decided to go to Afghanistan.
When I first got into the military, I mean, I was thinking it was kind of a win-win. It was a force for good in the world. I could actually help people. I could go places. I could learn things. There was nothing negative about it at the time that was in my thinking or in my consciousness. And, you know, I thought I was going to be on the right side of history, and today I don't believe I was. I worked on a DGS, a distributed ground system. As the name implies, I mean, it's a distributed system, and it spans the globe, and it eats data, and it eats lots and lots and lots of data. This is global. This is getting information anywhere at any time, shooting people from anywhere at any time, and it's not just one person sitting there with a little remote control, a little joystick, moving around a plane that's halfway across the world. That's not all there is. It's like borders don't matter anymore, and there's a huge system that spans the globe that can just suck up endless amounts of your life, your personal data. I mean, this could grow to get so out of control. And we're not the only ones that have this. This is going to be commonplace, if it's not already. It's a secret program. And what that means is that I can't just go shouting off the hilltops telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, one person who worked within this massive thing, it's frightening. There's a bomb, they drop it. It explodes. Then what? The
somebody go down there and ask for somebody's driver's license? Excuse me, sir, can I have your driver's license, see who you are? I mean, does that happen? How do we know? How is it possible to know who ends up living or dying? One of my neighbors, her name's Asma, and she was born in Afghanistan. And she goes there every year distributing seeds and doing humanitarian work. And Asma's willing to take me this year, and it's a beautiful thing. I'm aware that Afghanistan is a dangerous place. I'm aware that there's still war going on there. But I believe that doing this is the right thing to do. I lost part of my humanity working in the drone program, and humanity was what was missing there, and seeing these people as human beings. When I meet these people, part of it is making reparations for my participation in a program that's a huge, huge weapon system that kills more innocent people than actual targets. There's no way that I can make amends or change anything that I've participated in. But if there's any way that I can somehow give back to that country, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to be helpful, even just a little bit, by talking to somebody who's been directly impacted by the drone program and asking, what do you need? What do you want people to hear? Basically, how can I be helpful? Because being a part of a weapon system can't be helpful. It can only be hurtful.
That's a piece from The National Bird, the DVD, which is a premium here at KPFA today, which should be in everybody's home and shared with your entire family, shared with your church, shared at your children's school, shared in general, so that we have an understanding and can see the realities of this assassination murder program being done in our name worldwide. It's appalling for many here. And of course, you can reinforce your knowledge of this by not only watching the film and putting a pledge in for $110 to KPFA today by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We need you to do that, keeping KPFA alive, keeping us this voice, this opportunity to tell the truth, to speak this truth to power, to call our political elites what they are, murderers. There's no other way to say it. And when we allow this to happen in our name, we're complicit. We're part of the problem if we can't speak out and engage in saying no to this. And it's not just writing letters. I mean, you could write letters. We can try, to educate people. But we also have to make that sacrifice of opening our wallets to support where the biggest opportunity to tell people can be. And that's KPFA here in Berkeley. Thousands, tens of thousands of people listen to this radio station, and they don't hear this message. You don't see this message in the corporate media. You don't hear about drone strikes in Afghanistan unless they say, oh, well, we killed a bunch of militants today. And that's how it's described. There may be a little paragraph in the back of page 6. That's not right. And Jeremy Scahill lays this out in the assassination complex, the chain of command of how people are selected to be killed. Thousands of people are on this potential list. If they can identify them and follow them on their cell phones, if they use a cell phone, their SIM card is identified, then they're followed. Just like the police do here locally with the Stingray program, where they can pretend to be a cell tower and your phone will light into them, and then they can follow you wherever you are. That technology is here, and the idea of drones are borderless means that we are all the chickens and being subject to review and monitored. It's frankly scary. It's one of the scariest things I think I've looked at this year. And so we have the book, The Assassination Complex by Jeremy Scahill. We have the DVD, The National Bird, both for $180 pledge. We'd like to see some of those coming in. This is a way to educate yourself, educate others, by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, and raising money here for this station to support us. With me in studio are two Code Pink activists, Toby Blome and Ella Levine, who I'm going to ask to say why they think it's important that we must do this.
Well, first of all, what's on my mind right now is the emphasis on the civilians, which is the most tragic side of this whole story. But I also want to address the militants don't deserve to be assassinated and executed either. That the U.S. is the aggressor in these countries. We've invaded. We've occupied. Afghanistan is one of the very poorest countries in the world. We've been there for 16 years. And, we carried on the Vietnam War for 10 years with the threat of communism scaring America. We ended the war, and communism didn't spread around the world. You know, whether it would have been good or bad is another subject, but... You know, ISIS is not a threat to the United States or the public. I think these countries have to figure out their own problems. We helped create ISIS. Like getting out of these countries will help, end all these other, it'll bring down, as the drone whistleblower said, the number one thing causing extremism in the world is terrorism. And I just want to say, Peter, I especially want to acknowledge these very courageous young people who've come out of the drone program and are speaking out, and particularly want to praise Brandon Bryan for being the very first drone operator to publicly speak out against the drone program. He, to be the first one, took a lot of courage. And these people are wounded soldiers, and it's going to take them a long time to heal, but part of healing is being able to talk about it and making these crimes against humanity so public. So I praise them. I appreciate them deeply. I hope that we can all work together to end this craziness.
We have one more clip. It's a very short one. And this is Lisa talking about in an interview after leaving the military and how she, the interview in the film, she reacts to a transcript of pilots and drone operators talking to each other. Let's hear that clip.
See, this is what pissed me off. Where these, they're saying in here, DGS supposedly sees women and children. They're saying DGS supposedly sees it. We went to school for almost a year to be able to identify women and children. And this is a daily thing. Where the pilot and the SOs and everybody that's at Creech is constantly saying, no, DGS is full of shit. They don't see anything. This happened all the time. And I'd have to literally sit there arguing with these and have them just be saying like this to the people that I can't talk to because I don't have access to talk to them. God damn the DGS dude, Creech, because they were always trying to kill people. They always wanted to be blowing someone up. And all these officers, the MIC, the pilot, all these people, it looks good on their resume if they kill more people. I know what crews did this mission, and it wasn't at my base. I can safely say that, because I remember this call sign. This DGS wasn't my DGS, but they're all set up the same in terms of the people that are working them. I couldn't talk about this stuff because it's classified. But now that I have this unclassified thing sitting right in front of me of these saying all this about us. We were the ones who had to try to stop them all the time. You shouldn't have to stop your own people from killing civilians.
And if you get that DVD, you will hear that statement without the beeps and that we cannot put on the air here. But it's part of the emotion of Heather and Lisa and Daniel, who are whistleblowers in this, and were part of the program. And are now describing the terribleness of it. And we ask you right now, we just have 5 minutes left here on our show, and we really want to go out strong. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call to support KPFA, to pick up the DVD, The National Bird, which you should share with your entire world. the book, The Assassination Complex by Jeremy Scahill, for a $90 pledge, the DVD for a $110 pledge, both of them together for a $180 pledge. That's really part of your way of engaging and supporting KPFA, engaging and supporting peace in this world, mollifying our consciences, our conscience, to that we are engaged in doing something, trying to do something about the United States assassination program. And it's gotten more severe under the current administration. You imagine it down the road in a few years with Trump at the helm. You know, people dying all over the world every day. Oh, blow them up here, blow them up there. They're all terrorists. They're all foreigners. And so we'll deport them from here and blow them up there. And if we can't do that, maybe we'll start blowing some up here. And that, it's just, it's terrifying. It's diabolical. It's amazingly important for us to address. Please call right now, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Donate online at kpfa.org. Pick up a copy of the DVD, The National Bird, for $110. Donation to KPFA, The Assassination Complex by Jeremy Scahill, $90 to both together for a $180 pledge. We need your support. This Project Censored show, as we're going now on 6.5 years, we're proud to be here. We're proud to be part of this. I'm an academic. I'm a professor. I teach this in school. And professors all over should be teaching this and showing this film to their students. This needs to be part of the national discourse of what's happening in the world and really talked about. Toby, say what you're thinking, Toby.
Well, I so am grateful for Peter talking about how this film has to be spread all over. It's an incredibly educational tool that can be used in so many ways, and I'm especially grateful that he brought up the education of young people. We need to take this film into the schools, the universities. We need to educate the young in the high schools. We need to have these conversations at the high school level before these young people sign up to be part of this murdering, mass murdering program called the U.S. Drone Program. Thank you, Peter, for speaking so well for all of us.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Noam Chomsky, Racing to the Precipice. Within days of the public posting in early April 2017 of this one-hour speech, the downloads for YouTube alone exceeded 100,000. Noam Chomsky spoke with such critical passion and urgency that this talk should have the widest possible distribution. So TUC Radio will carry it as well. It's a combination of a no-holds-barred critique of the Trump administration under the auspices of climate change and nuclear danger. The reason why this March 23, 2017 speech has become so popular, I believe, is that it not only brings into focus the looming danger that can sometimes feel overwhelming, but puts it into context of history, global justice, indigenous rebellion, and equity. Chomsky investigates the reasons for our failure to address climate change, which he calls the most awesome challenge, with possible exception of nuclear, that we're facing today. And in this part one of the talk, he paints a picture of the U.S. under Trump, virtually alone in the world, heading actively for destruction, while most of the rest of the world is attempting to ward off catastrophe. It's easy to explain one part of the current wave of climate change denial, the monetary interests of the fossil fuel corporations involved and of the banks and shareholders who benefit are all very transparent. But the questions of civilization, consciousness, of our sense of purpose, and the values we want to uphold in a society that is moving so rapidly towards the precipice, as Chomsky calls it, are much harder to define. All this is touched upon in this talk in a way that can be inspiring as well as sobering. Against the background of a diary of bad decisions, as well as important climate change facts, Chomsky is giving credit to thinkers and a body of ideas that can be so helpful. It's an analysis that can become the foundation of action and response. Noam Chomsky spoke at the MIT Star Forum on March 23, 2017. He was introduced as an American philosopher, historian, social critic, and political activist. He is Institute Professor Emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he has worked since 1955, and is the author of over 100 books on topics such as war, politics, and mass media. Ideologically, he aligns with anarcho-syndicalism and libertarian socialism. Here's Noam Chomsky with the opening section of his talk, Racing to the Precipice.
For quite a few years, I've been intrigued by an interesting debate that took place about 25 years ago between two great scientists, Carl Sagan, Ernst Mayr. They were discussing the likelihood of finding intelligent life, extraterrestrial intelligent life. And Sagan, who looked at it from the point of view of an astrophysicist, calculated the number of planets, more or less like Earth, and concluded that the chances are quite high. Mayr, looking at it as a biologist, said, look, we have only one test case, namely Earth, which has had about 50 billion species, and we can raise the question whether what are the criteria for biological success on Earth with 50 billion cases to look at. And he pointed out that there is a striking regularity. The species that are successful, that a lot of them around basically, are those that mutate quickly, like bacteria, or those that have a fixed niche, like beetles, and they just stay there no matter what happens. And as you move up the scale of what we call intelligence, biological success declines. So there are not many mammals. There are very few apes. The only reason there's a lot of cows is because we domesticate them. But by and large, biological success declines as intelligence increases. Humans look like an exception, but that's a statistical blip, just a tiny moment of evolutionary time, last couple thousand years, actually. So his conclusion is that, I'll quote him, "The history of life on Earth refutes the claim that it is better to be smart than to be stupid." What it shows, in fact, is it's much better to be stupid than smart. That's the conclusion. He also points out that the average lifespan of a species is about 100,000 years. We've doubled it. We're about 200,000, so we're a little beyond the expected extinction point. Well, that's the question I want to consider today. Is it better to be smart than stupid? Was addressed recently by a very good Indian writer, Amitav Ghosh, has a book called The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. And in fact, our failure to address the most awesome challenge of human history, with the possible exception of nuclear weapons, is indeed a true derangement. and painful evidence for the plausibility of Meyer's thesis that it's better to be stupid than smart. Well, these are the two existential challenges that overwhelm anything else, completely overshadow all other discussions. And their severity and their imminence is illustrated graphically by the famous doomsday clock of the Bulletin of American Scientists. It was initiated in 1947, right at the dawn of the nuclear age. In 2015 and again in 2016, it was moved, the hand was moved forward. Midnight means we're finished. The hand was moved forward to 3 minutes to midnight. That's the closest it had been to midnight since the early 1980s, when there was a major war scare in the early Reagan years. The reasons that they gave were the mounting threat of nuclear war and the failure to deal with climate change. I'll quote what they said is, at the time, the probability of global catastrophe is very high, and the actions needed to reduce the risks of disaster must be taken very soon. That was 2016. At the outset of the Trump term, they found, I'm quoting, the danger to be even greater, the need for action more urgent, and they moved the clock to 2.5 minutes to midnight. The clock is ticking, global danger looms. That's the closest to terminal disaster since 1953, when the United States and Russia exploded their H-bombs. Well, there is an important difference between these two existential threats. If, by some miracle, we escape nuclear disaster, and anyone who looks at the shocking record will realize that it's a miracle that we've gotten this far. But if by some miracle we do escape, at least we know in principle how to end the plague, get rid of the scourge. Global warming is different. It's inexorable. We might pass a point of no return when the damage that we've done is simply uncontrollable, irreversible, and it might not be far off. Well, the human species is right now undertaking an experiment to determine the answer to Ernst Mayr's question, is it better to be smart than stupid? And to examine, what I'd like to do now is to examine the course of the experiment just by picking a few dates. So let's start with today. Could be any day, but we'll start with today. If you looked at this morning's newspapers, you see a report on how we're dealing with the two existential crises. One on the nuclear threat. Christopher Ford, the National Security Council Senior Director for Weapons of Mass Destruction and Counterproliferation under the Trump administration, he advises that we should reconsider the unrealistic goal of a world without nuclear weapons that has been advocated, among others, by extremist peaksniks like Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Sam Nunn, and William Perry. And the reason for abandoning this unrealistic goal of these utopians is Russia's increased aggressiveness, which is incidentally a charge that's dismantled quite effectively in the current issue of Radical Rag that's worth reading now and then, Foreign Affairs, the main establishment journal. On global warming, today, this morning, the National Snow and Ice Data Center reports that the Arctic has less sea ice at winter's end now than ever before. That means more dark ocean, hence more absorption of solar energy, more warming, and we're in a feedback loop, and you know what that means. The mean temperature for November was 23 degrees above normal, and at some points in the last couple of months, it went to more than 35 degrees warmer than normal. Well, that's today's good news. Let's go back to yesterday. Quote from the Washington Post. Water temperatures at the surface of the Gulf of Mexico and near South Florida are on fire. They spurred a historically warm winter from Houston to Miami. In the Gulf, the average sea surface temperature never fell below 73 degrees over the winter for the first time on record. Galveston, Texas has tied or broken an astonishing 33 record highs since November 1st, while neighboring Houston had its warmest winter on record. Both cities have witnessed precious few days with below normal temperatures since late fall, and on and on. Well, I apologize if this is unfair, but I can't refrain from quoting one of the comments by a reader on this news report. He says, "The Republicans have all this under control. The plan is to have Jeff Sessions and Ted Cruz's dad stand at the shoreline with Bibles in hand. As the sky darkens and the water rises, they will raise their left hand, holding the Bible, and command the seas to settle. And if that fails, Plan B is to run like hell and to blame Obama." Which couldn't say it's better. It's a classic. And it captures the spirit of the times very accurately. Well, there was a second report yesterday in the business press, Bloomberg Business Week. The headline was, "The oil boom is back." And I'll quote it. "The number of oil and gas rigs drilling in the United States has almost doubled since bottoming out at the lowest level in more than 75 years of records. While two dozen nations are coordinating to cut oil production and rein in the global supply glut, U.S. producers are moving in the opposite direction. Over the last 4 months, output increased by 500,000 barrels a day. And if that rate of expansion continues, the shale boom will break new production records by summer. The U.S. now produces 9 million barrels a day." We're way in the lead. This illustrates a very crucial fact of current history. The world outside the United States is taking steps, halting steps, but steps towards facing the existential challenge to survival. And meanwhile, the United States, virtually alone, is racing towards destruction with enthusiasm and dedication, which is quite a remarkable fact. Now, of course, the oil industry has plenty of help in helping and moving as quickly as it can to destroy the chances for survival. The IMF reports that the fossil fuel industry extracts a $700 billion annual taxpayer subsidy, which is not in the crosshairs of Mike Mulvaney, I'm sure. And the industry doesn't take chances. In 2016, it spent $117 million in campaign contributions while fielding 720 lobbyists in Washington to make sure that Congress gets the message. And apparently it does. There's a recent Washington Post article which reports that many Republicans in Congress do recognize the severe threat of climate change, but they won't talk about it because of funding pressures from the fossil fuel industry. That's particularly true since Citizens United opened the floodgates even wider for a flood of corporate political funding, which means you toe the corporate line or you're out. Well, that's yesterday. These reports are quite typical of the daily fare. Pick almost any day, find similar things. Well, let's continue to review the experiment that humans are undertaking. I'll just pick a few recent dates from the last few months. So start with November 8th. That was an important day in history for several reasons. Several events took place on November 8th. One of them was very important. Second one was extremely important. And the third was absolutely astonishing. The very important one was the election in the United States. Plenty of coverage of that, so I don't have to talk about it. The extremely important one took place in Morocco. In Morocco, on November 8th, about 200 countries were gathering in, it's called COP22, the international conference under UN auspices to try to deal with the problem of global warming. The goal of the conference was to put some teeth into the Paris negotiations the year before, COP21, December 2015. Now, that conference had aimed to establish a verifiable treaty, but it couldn't do it for one reason. The Republican Congress would not accept any binding commitments. So therefore, the world had to settle for something less, namely informal agreements. And COP22 in Marrakesh, Morocco, was supposed to carry this forward. Well, on November 8th, the conference began. On November 8th, the World Meteorological Association delivered a report, which in their words confirms that 2016 was the warmest year on record, a remarkable 1.1 degrees centigrade above the pre-industrial period, sharply above the previous record set the year before, and in fact approaching the desired limit that was set in Paris as the goal, and other dire reports, which I won't read, but you can pick them up on the internet if you want. Well, that was the World Meteorological Association. But then the deliberations essentially ended. The election results came in from the United States. The conference essentially stopped. Nothing more to discuss. The only question was whether it would be possible to salvage anything from the wreckage with the world's most important country, the richest, most powerful country in world history, having all three branches of government committed to racing to destruction. What could be done? And there was some hope. They looked to one country as the possible savior, namely China. That was November 8th, the extremely important event on November 8th. The conference went on but concluded without issue. Well, the third event was absolutely astonishing, namely, the leader of the free world is leading the world to disaster. The world is looking to China to save it. And what's the reaction? Silence. Not a word about it. Pick up the newspapers on November 9th. Listen to BBC on November 9th and the days that followed, and you see nothing about this. Here's one of the most astounding events in history. The world's most powerful country in history, extraordinary advantages, incomparable, racing to lead the world to disaster. And the world is hoping that maybe China can somehow save us. Can you think of an event like that in history? Not a word about it. That's the astonishing fact of November 8th. Well, that's November 8th. Let's move forward to March 1st. Talk about both the world and the United States. In the world, a study was released showing that tens of thousands of miles of permafrost in northwest Canada are rapidly melting, along with accelerating decline of permafrost in Alaska, Siberia, and Scandinavia. And it pointed out that this could lead to massive, huge release of greenhouse gases, CO2 and methane, which is accelerated, of course, by the unprecedented Arctic heat wave, which gets radically worse every year. That's the world. In the United States, the Trump administration on March 1st decided to help the process along by rescinding the so-called methane rule, which limits release of methane from oil and gas drilling sites on federal lands. So that's a way of accelerating the oil boom and increasing the flow of methane into the atmosphere. Methane is far more dangerous than CO2, even though it's short-lived. There was also on March 1st announcements of sharp cuts in the Environmental Protection Agency staff and programs, and also an edict banning research. We don't want to learn about these things. That was March 1st. Let's turn to March 16th, the world. A new study was released on the damage to the Great Barrier Reef, one of the world's greatest living structures, which is damage that's quite intensifying. And the report said that it's by far the most widespread and damaging of recent mass bleachings of coral reefs since 1998, with wide-ranging disastrous effects that most of you know about. Well, that was the world. The United States, on March 16th, the Trump budget was released. Environmental Protection Agency is virtually dismantled. It's now pretty much run by Senator Inhofe and his associates. Inhofe, for years, has been the leading climate change denier in the Senate. He's an extreme fundamentalist, and his position is that if God is warming the earth, so be it. It would be sacrilegious to interfere with God's will. That's the view in the most powerful, advanced, sophisticated country in the world. And that's the least of it. For action and research on climate, the EPA is actually a small actor. Far more important is the Department of Energy. It's now in the hands of a guy who had decided to get rid of it a couple of years ago before he learned that it controls nuclear weapons, so we better keep it. You know? But not entirely. The Office of Science, according to the budget, is in the Department of Energy, is scheduled to lose $900 million. That's nearly 20% of its budget. Its $300 million ARPA energy program is eliminated completely. Now, that's along with deep cuts in research programs at the EPA and the NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and also a 5% cut to NASA's Earth Science budget. Well, the budget generally is of unusual savagery, even for the Paul Ryan wing of the Republican establishment, which is effectively running the show now behind the Trump, Spicer, Twitter facade that's designed to grab the headlines every day. The budget, if you look at it, is a vicious attack on working class and the poor. It lavishes even more gifts on the wealthy and the corporate sector, and along with a process that you can only describe, I think, as the Talibanization of America, in accord with the Bannon, Sessions, DeVos ideal of a society which they've described based on Judeo-Christian tradition, white supremacy, destruction of the humanities, arts, and public schooling, and on the side, medical research. That's the goal towards which we're aiming at home while we race towards destruction internationally.
That was the first half of a one-hour talk by Noam Chomsky, Racing to the Precipice. He spoke at the Star Forum at MIT on March 23, 2017. Noam Chomsky is Institute Professor Emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. There he has worked since 1955, and he's the author of over 100 books. Come back when TUC Radio returns for the conclusion of this talk. Chomsky will address climate by commenting on latest science, including the passing of 400 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. That's considered a danger point. He also quotes Stephen Colbert on North Carolina's estimate that sea level might rise 39 inches. Followed by the passing of a law 2 years ago by Republican state legislators that banned anticipating any rise in sea level. Chomsky also addresses the climate aspects of the global refugee crisis and quotes the chief environmental scientist in Bangladesh. He says refugees should have the right to move to the countries from which the greenhouse gases are coming that are drowning their homes. Chomsky defines the Anthropocene, where human activity is dramatically changing the environment, and refers to the World Geological Society. They say that the nuclear age and the Anthropocene basically coincide. And he advances a very interesting definition of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, by quoting a study that claims that NATO's prime concern is now to manage the risk created by its very existence. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm assistant producer Angie Voiles-Ascom, sitting in for Barry Vogel. In September of 2015, Barry visited with Dr. Guy R. McPherson, co-author with Carolyn Baker of Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. McPherson is professor emeritus of natural resources, ecology, and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona. This archive program is the first of a series on near-term extinction of the human species. Dr. McPherson's predictions about the effects of climate change are hauntingly prescient, heard a year and a half later. As you listen, consider the following. Is what McPherson predicted occurring? Has climate change affected your life? What have you done, or what are you doing differently as a consequence? And what are your future plans regarding climate change? Here's Barry Vogel.
The point from which average global temperature rise is measured dates back to 1750, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the time at which the ever-increasing use of fossil fuels began. Since 1750, the planet has been warmed by more than 1 degree centigrade, 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit. McPherson's book, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, explains how this small global rise in temperature is leading to a large-scale mass extinction on the planet Earth. When Guy McPherson and I visited by phone on September 14, 2015, while he was traveling near New York City, we began our conversation when I asked him to describe the indicators that reveal we are in an era of unstoppable climate change.
clearly at this point in the midst of the sixth mass extinction, the sixth mass extinction event in the history of planet Earth. This one, though, is being driven by a single species, ours. As we drive to extinction, 150 to 200 species every day, according to a report from the United Nations, now more than 5 years old. So it's undoubtedly conservative, was conservative then and is undoubtedly conservative now. In addition to that, all that, we still are warming the planet every year. We're on track for 2015 to be the warmest year in planetary history. That will eclipse the record set last year, 2014, when the global average temperature was 1.17 degrees Celsius above that baseline from 1750. So again, it doesn't sound like much, but these are tremendous changes when you warm a planet the size of ours and warm the amount of water on this planet. We're basically a water planet. You warm all that water, it takes a tremendous amount of heat to get that done. So we're well past the point at which we can say with any sort of certainty that if we stop now, if we stop warming the planet now, it's all going to be fine.
Well, before we get there, let's go back to your comment that 150 species become extinct every day. What are some of those species?
Well, mostly they're species that we don't even actually identify. To firmly declare that a species has gone extinct, biologists require many years to pass since its most recent sighting. So that 150 to 200 species that the United Nations was discussing in their August report from 2010 is based upon estimates. And particularly if a certain species, we'll call it a keystone species, if it goes extinct, then what other species go down with it? So it's an indicator or a keystone species. And there's been a lot of work done on that very topic by conservation biologists. But among the species that are going extinct, that already have gone extinct, are things like amphibians, which are particularly sensitive to changes in atmospheric chemistry and to temperature. So things like leopard frogs. But for the most part, to be honest, it's things that we don't identify with very well. It's organisms that we even have difficulty seeing or identifying with because they don't have warm, fuzzy faces like us. So they're microbes and bacteria. They're fungi and these little things that we think aren't doing anything for us, but in fact they're providing for all or most of our food at some level, and they're providing for decomposition of dead plant material, for example.
Let's look at the changes that have been happening since 1750, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, that are having the effect on our world and primarily on the Homo sapiens, on us.
So in addition to the global average rise in temperature, which is already at the slow, relatively linear rate of change we have triggered so far, that's outstripping habitat for non-human species. That includes things like food. In addition, we see all kinds of catastrophe around us on a pretty regular basis. For the people who are paying attention, we're seeing superstorms, the likes of which we've never observed before. Since 2005 with Katrina, there has been a 100-year event in terms of storms or floods or drought on a very regular basis, seemingly on a weekly basis. The storms that have arisen since Katrina are legion and include Sandy, and more recently, the Typhoon Haiyan that struck the Philippines. And it's not just storms that have the power to level cities. It's fires that we no longer have the ability to control because they're burning so hot and so fast. And here we need only look to almost anywhere in the northern half of the northern hemisphere. From Siberia to Canada to Alaska to California, the fires are really pretty impressive at this point.
Well, Guy McPherson, what are the causes of the megastorms, the superstorms, the El Niños, the fires that you speak of?
This is relatively simple thermodynamics. You add heat to a system, and the system tries to come into equilibrium by releasing that heat. And among the most rapid ways to release heat are in the forms of funnels. Think when you flush the toilet, the vortex that forms. Think of tornadoes. Think of hurricanes. These are things that spiral. And all those are examples of rapid energy release. In the ocean, what we're seeing is hurricanes that are driven by greater heat than they've ever been driven before, at least in human history. And so the attempt by the oceans to release the heat that have been absorbed by the oceans over the last couple hundred years is producing hurricanes. On land, it's producing tornadoes. On land, it's producing a bunch of fuel, dry fuel, which in the ignition source then allows to release energy even faster in the form of these catastrophic wildfires. So there's all kinds of ways that systems attempt to come into equilibrium. And the current system is out of equilibrium in that there's a lot more energy, a lot more heat in the oceans, in terrestrial regions than there ever has been in human history. And so how does the planet get rid of that heat? It attempts to by hurricanes and tornadoes and all these other things that we've been talking about so far.
Guy, I want to ask you about what is causing the change in this heat of which the Earth's systems are moving into an equilibrium.
What we have so far is carbon dioxide being emitted through industrial activity. And that carbon dioxide traps more of the heat than would otherwise be trapped in Earth's atmosphere. So in 1750, for example, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, up until that point in human history, the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere was never more than 280 parts per million. Now it's at about 400 parts per million. And each molecule of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere enables the atmosphere to trap more heat. It's like putting on blankets at night. The blankets don't directly make it warmer. They just hold the heat against your body, against the bed. And so that's what the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is doing right now, is holding that heat close to the planet. So that's just carbon dioxide, which has increased about 40% since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in the atmosphere. And then let's take a look at one other from among the handful of greenhouse gases. Let's take a look at methane or methane. Methane has about 100 times the power as a greenhouse gas of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Methane is currently at about 240% higher than it was at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So there we have two greenhouse gases that are trapping heat that is produced by the sun, and the shortwave radiation strikes the Earth. Shortwave and longwave radiation tries to leave the Earth and go back out into the atmosphere. And the greenhouse gases, including water vapor, methane, carbon dioxide, ozone, chlorofluorocarbons, all those serve to trap the heat in longwave radiation before it can get back out into space. So that's climate change 101.
Well, let's stay with that for a few minutes. But before we go there, in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Professor Guy McPherson, a professor emeritus from the University of Arizona, who, along with Carolyn Baker, is the author of Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. I'm Barry Vogel. This is Radio Curious. Guy, talk about the activities on the Earth since 1750, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, that has resulted in this radical increase of carbon dioxide and methane gas.
The big one there is burning fossil fuels. And it was 1750 that we began burning fossil fuels at scale. Now, there's little question that humans were burning fossil fuels in relatively small amount. Well, about 1750, we started to come up with ideas like the steam engine. Oh, now we can go faster. we can warm a whole bunch of people. Now we start building cities, much larger cities, and we start burning fossil fuels to stay warm and to heat the water that we so enjoy. There's nothing quite like a hot shower. So in 1750 and beyond, we started burning those fossil fuels at much larger scale to enable convenience increasingly to become part of our lives. And why not? I mean, we're just like other animals in that if there's a shortcut, we're going to find it through trial and error. And if it's a shortcut that makes our lives more convenient, we're going to remember how that happened and keep returning back to it. So it was in roughly 1750 that we discovered things like, an internal combustion engine. By 1850, those things were starting to be built. And by the early 1900s, you know, with Henry Ford, they were being built very, very quickly. And by the time we get to 1900, or even 1850, the cities are well established. Almost everything about the city is propped up by fossil fuels, burning coal, burning steam, building the roads, providing the transport, the rapid transport, so that the food can show up in the grocery stores. Everything that we've come to hold dear and take for granted about those cities has become completely dependent upon the exploitation of fossil fuels and the burning of fossil fuels at a very large scale. Turning back the clock is pretty tough, especially at the level of entire societies.
So talk about methane and its source and its consequences.
Yeah, methane is produced from a couple of ways, quote, naturally on the planet. In addition, it's a fossil fuel, too. Another word for methane is natural gas. It's CH4 is the chemical description of it. So we burn natural gas to heat our homes and to heat our water. Yeah, out in nature, when permafrost degrades, it decomposes into methane and carbon dioxide and water. Out in the relatively shallow seafloor, especially in the Arctic Ocean, which is warming much faster than the rest of the planet, there's a bunch of methane trapped in chemical cages called clathrates or hydrates. Those clathrates or hydrates, when they warm up just a little bit, the chemical cage breaks, which releases the methane, the CH4, directly into the water column or directly into the atmosphere. That methane has, in the short term of a decade or so, has the heating power, molecule for molecule, about 100 times higher than that of carbon dioxide. So whereas methane is measured in the parts per billion, so we're talking about relatively low numbers compared to the parts per million of carbon dioxide, the impact is great because it is such a tremendous trapper of heat. Carbon dioxide is good. Water vapor is good. But methane is great at trapping long-wave radiation and holding it close to the planet.
How is the methane being released to get in the position to trap?
Well, two primary ways, three primary ways, really. One, as we frack, we lose a lot of methane directly into the atmosphere. So that's just natural gas that is leaking out into the atmosphere as we try to exploit it and capture it. The second way is natural, quote, natural decomposition of permafrost as the permafrost warms, releases a lot of methane into the atmosphere. And so what we've done now is create an environment in which the methane is being released ever faster as the permafrost has turned into permamelt for all practical purposes. The Earth has warmed only about 1 degree Celsius above where it was in 1750, but that's enough to drive rapid release of methane from permafrost by melting the methane. And the third source is the clathrates or hydrates in the relatively shallow sea floor, mostly in the Arctic, but also off the west coast of the United States, off the east coast of the United States, the Ring of Fire around New Zealand. There's a lot of methane clathrates that are giving up the methane there. As the clathrates heat up, those chemical cages break, and allow the methane to be released into the water column or into the atmosphere. So 1 degree Celsius temperature rise at the level of the planet doesn't sound like a heck of a lot, but the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases in October of 1990 announced their conclusion that 1 degree Celsius is the absolute upper limit beyond which we cannot go above that 1750 baseline. Well, guess what? We're there. They pointed out that beyond that 1 degree Celsius Rubicon, we would trigger all kinds of self-reinforcing feedback loops. Well, as it turns out, that very upper limit was way too conservative. As David Spratt points out in a video from October 2014, half a degree Celsius was a more reasonable target, and we passed that point a long time ago. So we've already triggered dozens, literally dozens, of self-reinforcing feedback loops.
Let's stay with self-reinforcing feedback loops. Can you explain that?
Sure. So these self-reinforcing feedback loops are the snake eating its own tail. The phenomenon, once triggered, that goes ever faster and becomes beyond the ability to control. So, for example, it's the runaway train that the engineer had a heart attack and died right after filling the coal bin, and it's going downhill. So that the faster it goes, the more ground it covers. The more ground it covers, the faster it goes. There's no stopping it. It goes ever faster, and there's no longer an engineer to even hit the brakes. And there are no brakes at the level of methane being released from the subsea permafrost in the Arctic Ocean. There are no brakes with respect to the permafrost that has become the permamelt. All of these self-reinforcing feedback loops are now beyond our ability to control, because once triggered, there's no stopping them. It's the snowball that starts rolling down the hill. It gets ever bigger, picks up more mass as it goes, and as it picks up more mass, it goes faster. As it goes faster, it picks up more mass. That's the self-reinforcing feedback loop. An excellent example from climate science is the Arctic ice. So as long as the Arctic is covered with a bunch of ice, in the North American summertime, the sun strikes it. It's a bunch of snow and ice. It's light-colored, so the incoming sunlight is reflected back out into space. But the Arctic ice is going away. And so now the sun strikes the Arctic, and instead of being bounced off by all that ice, the incoming radiation is absorbed by the open ocean, by that blue, that dark blue water that soaks in the incoming radiation instead of bouncing it off. So that's a classic self-reinforcing feedback loop. The smaller the ice gets, the more radiation is soaked up by the Earth, and the hotter the Arctic gets, and so the faster the ice melts. And the faster the ice melts, the more radiation gets soaked up instead of being reflected. It just keeps going. There's no stopping it.
So you say in your book, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, that there's no politically viable way to deal with this problem. When I read that, what came to my recollection was in the United States in January of 1942, at the beginning of World War II, President Roosevelt said that all car manufacturers will retool and begin to manufacture airplanes, and the people who worked in those plants were women, and the men went to war. Do you see anything like that that can be done now with the current situation as you describe it?
Up until a few years ago, probably 2007, there are things that could have been done that would have reversed or prevented runaway climate change. It appears that 2007 was the year methane went exponential in the atmosphere. And so we were at that point when permafrost was perennially melting and methane was being released from beneath the shell of seafloor of the Arctic Ocean. Interestingly, 2007 was when Tim Garrett wrote his epic paper pointing out that civilization is a heat engine. So at that point, the world leaders could have stepped forward and said, civilization itself is a heat engine. We know that we're overheating the planet. What we have to do is turn off the heat engine. We need to turn off civilization itself. It doesn't matter whether we use solar panels or wind turbines or wave power or fossil fuels. Civilization itself is a heat engine. We need to turn it off. So we're asking everybody to do that World War II effort times a few million. That's the order of magnitude we're talking about. Times a few million. So we need everybody to stop burning fossil fuels right now. We need to give up on the idea of economic growth or even a steady state economy. We need to bring this whole thing down to the level of the early 1700s in terms of our technology. And we need to do that this week. Okay, we'll give you a little break. We'll give you until the end of the month. So when I say there's no politically viable approach to dealing with climate change, that's what I'm talking about. You can imagine any politician that said that in the year 2007 would have not only been voted out of office, but he might have been tarred and feathered.
What is your take on Pope Francis's recent encyclical on climate change?
It would have been a fine idea 20 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago. But at this point, it's too late. We've triggered all these self-reinforcing feedback loops. There's no going back. It's game over. So in the not-too-distant future, there will be no habitat for humans on this planet, like every other species.
Guy McPherson, what do you see as the short-term effect on our species when you use the term abrupt climate change?
I see a global average temperature rise beyond which humans have persisted at any point in the past on this planet. So what that means is we've never had humans on the planet at 3.3 degrees Celsius above baseline. And the number might be actually lower than that. The jury is still out. It might be as little as 2 or 2.5 degrees Celsius above that 1750 baseline. So when we talk about abrupt climate change, we're talking about the kinds of events that have happened throughout Earth's history. So, for example, 55 million years ago, there was an abrupt warming event that led to a 5 degrees Celsius temperature rise in a period of only 13 years, according to the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, published in October 2013. So there are these kinds of virtually instantaneous events with respect to geological timescales that have occurred in the past, and we're clearly at the early stages of that kind of event right now. In addition, we don't even need to look at methane. We don't even need to consider methane or the other greenhouse gases. Because of global dimming, if industrial civilization turns off the switch, bear in mind that industrial civilization is a heat engine, and so every minute that it remains on overheats the planet a little bit more, boils the water out of that pot a little bit more. If we turn it off, that produces catastrophic heating in a span of days or weeks, hot enough to take us beyond the point at which humans have persisted a day and time in the past. So
turning it off increases the heat?
Yes, because of global dimming. Industrial activity puts a bunch of particulates, notably aerosols, into the atmosphere, and those serve as something of an umbrella for Earth. And when the umbrella is gone, rapid heating ensues. And what could make the umbrella be gone? Well, industrial activity puts those aerosols, puts those atmospheric particles up into the atmosphere, and they're constantly falling out every day. Almost as many particulates fall out as are put up in the atmosphere. Once we stop putting them up into the atmosphere, they all fall out of the atmosphere in a span of days or so. So what that means is, you know, burning coal is a classic example. And high sulfur coal puts a lot of sulfates into the atmosphere that serves as a protective umbrella. Once we stop burning coal, the sulfates drop out of the sky and we lose the umbrella. So within a span of a few days, maybe a few weeks, after we turn off the heat engine, we experience unbelievably rapid heating as a result, up to a 3 degree Celsius temperature rise, according to a very conservative assessment, in a span of days after turning off the heat engine known as industrial civilization. So clearly, we're at this point, we're in the damned if you do and damned if you don't phase of abrupt climate change. We can either keep industrial civilization going and it heats up the planet more every day, or we can turn civilization off, a choice that people are not going to make willingly, by the way. And if we do that, then we experience very, very rapid heating in a very, very short period of time that takes us beyond the point at which humans have persisted on the planet.
Dr. Guy R. McPherson is a professor emeritus of natural resources, ecology, and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona. He and Carolyn Baker co-authored the book Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. This interview was recorded on September 14, 2015, but is strikingly relevant today. Consider if Dr. McPherson's climate change predictions have come true, and how climate change affects your life. What have you done, or what are you doing as a consequence? Dr. McPherson's book recommendations will be shared in the next program.
There are over 630 archive editions on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're all free to listen and download and share anytime, anywhere, as my gift to you. Our programs are published weekly, normally on Tuesday evening. Your comments, ideas, and suggestions are always appreciated, and we do enjoy hearing from you. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org. Postal mail is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, UKIAH, California 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Angie Voiles Askham is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.